Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. Captain Marvel is the topic of the day, the new superhero movie sensation that's sweeping the nation. I don't know, I just felt like I would talk in cliches for a second. Sean, we're going to be reviewing Captain Marvel in depth later on in the show in spoiler detail, but you want to give us your quick reaction? What'd you think of the latest Marvel movie and the first to star a woman superhero?
I like it quite a bit. Like, I think it's probably in that kind of like mid to mid lower range of Marvel movie, which is still good, but not like, it's not Thor Ragnarok or Black Panther levels, but it's in that kind of like Doctor Strange, Ant-Man-ish, like in that kind of range. It's good. It has some pacing problems and stuff, but Brie Larson as Carol Danvers is awesome. I really love the use of the setting and it being in the 90s and having like the sort of prequely Nick Fury stuff in there is really fun. And yeah, I think it's like a really well executed version of an origin movie, but it's just not the most exciting. And so it was, I think, coming off of a pretty hot streak of some really good Marvel movies with like Infinity War, Thor Ragnarok, and Black Panther. Obviously, Ant-Man 2 was in there somewhere in that mix. But like after like thinking like the highs of those, this one isn't quite up to that standard, but it's still very enjoyable.
Yeah, I probably agree with everything you just said. I think it's got, like, the things that are good about it are really good. You know, Brie Larson is fantastic. I think it's got a great look. It's got really good cinematography and some great production design. I think there's a turn the story takes that is one of my favorite turns I've seen in a Marvel movie. It's a really cool, different kind of story by the end than I think we usually get out of these films. I do think the script is messy. It feels a little like a first draft to me, just in terms of like getting from A to B to C often feels kind of messy. You know, I said this on Twitter, and I mean this both as something I like about the movie and as a little bit of a criticism, is it feels like, you remember when cartoons in the 80s and 90s would start, they would always do a like 3 to 5 episode pilot. And, like, Transformers did that, DuckTales did that. I remember, like, all the Disney shows, Chip and Dale, Tailspin, they all did this. And those could be really fun because you would get these, like, big origin stories over several episodes. Captain Marvel feels like you could cut it into, like, 6 or 7 20-minute episodes for Saturday mornings. And I like that about it. It feels like a Saturday morning cartoon come to life. I think Brie Larson is playing the character on that kind of big, you know, Saturday morning wavelength, kind of the way Chris Hemsworth plays Thor on that wavelength, you know? And it's a great performance and it's a lot of fun. It also feels a little episodic and jumpy to me in that way. But I do like it. I think it's a fun movie. It slides into the Marvel Universe very neatly. It's got a lot of cool kind of shout-outs to other movies. I also think, like, it's maybe the first Marvel movie in the MCU that feels pitched squarely at kids to me. And I don't mean that adults can't enjoy it. I mean that it feels like its primary audience, first and foremost, is like 10 to 12-year-olds. And I like that about it. Like a good kids movie is a great thing. And it definitely, when I fully let myself go, the way to enjoy it was enjoying it kind of as a kid on that wavelength. And I think it works in that way really well and very impressively, and it does feel like, you know, as much as it is an origin story in some ways, it also feels like something different in a lot of ways for Marvel, and it makes me excited to see what comes next, so I dug it.
Yeah, it's one of those where I came out of it really excited for a sequel and to see her in the next Avengers movie, which is in, like, sort of like the biggest job that this movie has with the way that the sort of Marvel movie cinematic universe stuff works is that it has to sell you on the character more than anything else, and it 100% does that.
Brie Larson is so great. I love her. I've loved her for a long time. I'll say it now in case I forget later. If you have not seen the movie Short Term 12 and you want to know why Brie Larson is a great actress, go watch the movie Short Term 12. Not enough people have seen it. It's amazing. She plays, in that case, a woman who works at a like home for foster youth, troubled kids, who has dealt with her own trauma in the past, and it's still her best performance. Like, she won the Oscar for the movie Room, and she's very, very good in that. But I think a lot of people have not seen Short Term 12, and like people are going to be introduced to her through Captain Marvel because Short Term 12 made like $1 million, and this movie's already made like $500 million. So, you know, that's just a recommendation I will make. If you want to see Sam Jackson in something, no, that would take too long if we listed all the good things Sam Jackson is in.
Yeah, that's its own like series of podcasts.
Yes, but wasn't it nice to have Sam Jackson in a Marvel movie again?
Yes, yeah, it's just been so long, and it makes me excited for the next Spider-Man movie, because he's going to be in that also. So it's like, yeah, let's get fucking Sam Jackson back in these movies. It's been too long.
He has so much fun. I think he's kind of always at his best when he is in a supporting role. The weight is not necessarily on him to deliver the movie. Not that he can't do that. In Pulp Fiction, he delivers the movie. But he is so good just kind of kicking in the background, you know? And he's great at that in this one, even if he is under a layer of CGI that is mostly good. So there we go. All right. We are also going to do some news today. We have our first look at Sonic the Hedgehog. We have some Microsoft news. We have some Nintendo news. We have some Disney news. Just a couple of quick pieces of news. So we'll get to that. We'll get to Captain Marvel. But Sean, first, what have you been up to?
Not a lot, because this week I had like two or three basically 12-hour days, because you had parent-teacher conferences and all that kind of shit. So yeah, it has not been a lot of free time for me.
Did you fight with any parents?
No, all the parents were very pleasant, which I was pleased with. I was ready to throw down, but it didn't come to that, luckily. No.
What would throwing down look like in that scenario?
You don't want to know. It's brutal. It's violent. It's just, you know, little shitty chairs in the gym just flying all over the place. Courtesy sandwiches being shoved into mouths. It's a lot. Yeah, but what I have been doing is I have gotten back into my Gundam bullshit.
Oh, nice.
Just because it's like, I just needed something I knew I liked and just, like, be in that for a little bit. So I've been rewatching the original Gundam show, and it's really fucking good. We should do something with Gundam sometime. We should just...
How many episodes are in the original Gundam?
The first series is 43 episodes long.
Okay. We could do that at some point.
We could totally do that. I feel like this podcast has a dearth of anime on it, because the only anime we talk about is Dragon Ball, which is awesome. But then I was watching Gundam, and I'm like, fucking Gundam's so good. But yeah, that's kind of the only thing I've been doing, is I've been watching a lot of Gundam.
Have you played any of the new Destiny 2 stuff?
No, I've not quite gotten to that yet.
Okay. It's fine. I don't have a ton to say about it. It's not as exciting to me as the Forge stuff from the last expansion, but you also like Gambit more than I do, so you might like it even more. Destiny still, you know, I'm having fun with that. I think I'm at the point where I probably need to find a new game. And I have to say, Sean, I've not played it yet, but the reviews for Devil May Cry 5 are good enough that I feel like I might want to take the plunge with that one. I've never tried that series, but I know that one. That game looks really good.
Yeah, I have been... There's a HD collection with the first three games and an updated version of Devil May Cry 4 that is on modern consoles, and I have been eyeing that in the PlayStation Store for, I swear, like 5 fucking months at this point, waiting for it to go on sale, because the new game is about to come out, so surely you're going to put the old ones on sale, and they fucking not come on sale.
Well, here's a good question.
I've been staring at it forever, and it's killing me.
Here's a question. You know more about Devil May Cry than I do. Do you need to play the other ones to play 5?
So I don't think so, really, in the sense of, like, the story is not hugely important. Like, I know enough about the story of Devil May Cry that I would be able to play Devil May Cry 5. I'm just more interested in, I would like to play those old games.
Yeah.
Because I did play, the only one I've played is the sort of weird reboot one that Ninja Theory made, that's just, like, DMC Devil May Cry, from, like, the later PS3 360 days. And I really like that game a lot. Obviously, it's, like, a totally different continuity and stuff. But it's the same style of character action game. But I've always been interested in the other Devil May Cry games kind of from a distance. And it felt like this is a really good opportunity to play those games. But I don't... Like, I just feel like I'm in a weird game of chicken with fucking the studio. Just like how... With Capcom. Like, Capcom, you are... I know you're going to put this on sale. Because it would be fucking madness not to put it on sale. So I'm not... Even though it's you know, it's a total reasonable price. It's like $45 for HD remakes of the first three games and the like HD remaster of the fourth one. And so it's like, that's a fair price for that. But if I know it's about to go on sale, I don't want to waste like $20. If it's going to be like half off tomorrow, it could be tomorrow. I don't know. I felt like it's going to be tomorrow forever.
Or you're going to finally break down and buy it full price and then it's a PS Plus game the next day or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly my fear.
Yeah.
So I've just been staring it down. But yeah, Devil May Cry 5 seems like it's really fucking good. I would like to play it, but I also want to play the old ones. So put it on sale, please, Capcom. Just do it. Just do it.
I have not.
You want to do it.
I have not played a new game yet this year. I mean, Destiny 2 has had new content, but I have not played a. And you know what, Sean? It feels so good.
Uh-huh.
It's irresponsible from a podcast host standpoint, but it feels so good.
Now that I'm thinking about it, I have been playing a different game. It's not a game that came out this year, though. I think it came out in 2015. It's called Gundam Versus.
Okay.
It's just a Gundam game. It's okay. I've just been playing it because I like Gundam stuff, and it was on sale for like $6 or something forever ago. So I picked it up. It's like, might as well. It's fun.
So I have one piece of stuff I'm going to talk about. I like to check in every so often on the CW shows, the DC shows. Supergirl, The Flash, Arrow, all of that stuff. Supergirl is the one I watch week to week. The Flash, I'm a season or two behind on, but I'll get to it later for reasons I'll tell you in a little bit. And Arrow, I want to see all of it one day, but it's like run for 8 seasons, so that's a lot of TV. But anyway, I do like this corner of the universe. I check in on Supergirl every so often. I think the last time I talked about this show was at mid-season when it ended in like December, and then it was off for a couple months, and then I finally caught up this weekend. I've still got a couple to catch up on, but one of the things I had to do was watch the big crossover event, because they do a crossover every year. And then one they did this December was... They're always so good, but this one was like... I just loved it. It was called Elseworlds. And the whole idea of this one is that the Monitor, who... Not the Monitor from Halo, the Monitor from DC,
yes,
gives Jeremy Davies from Lost... who's actually playing someone at Arkham Asylum, I forget the character's name, a like big book that rewrites reality, and the dude uses it to rewrite reality, and in the crossover, Barry Allen and Oliver Queen, the Flash and Green Arrow, like, they don't just switch bodies, like, reality completely swaps them, so the guy who looks like Oliver Queen, he's now Barry Allen, and the guy who looks like Barry Allen is now Oliver Queen, and they have each other's powers and everything, which is hilarious, because Oliver Queen does not actually have superpowers, he's like Batman, so what they have to explain is that he has an inner darkness, and, like, Barry, who is normally, like, happy and peppy because he's the Flash, has to, like, get in touch with his inner rage, and there's a great moment where he's, like, firing an arrow at like the bad guy who's this big robot, and he says, he's trying to like psych himself up so he can make sure he aims the arrow correctly, and he says, "You've failed this city," and fires it, and it's such a great moment. But anyway, that's like the setup, and then they go to Earth 38 to get Supergirl so she can help them out, and Supergirl comes over to Earth 1, and they have an adventure, and reality keeps being rewritten, and then Superman gets tied into it, the Tyler Hoechlin Superman, and he, and then the bad guy, the Jeremy Davis bad guy, takes over Superman's body, and we have a dark Superman. And we also meet Batwoman in this whole crossover, because they go to Gotham City, and Ruby Rose, who you might know from John Wick 2, she was one of the assassins, and she's done other stuff too. She plays Kate Kane, Batwoman.
Okay.
And it's really cool. Just like it has, it's really, this crossover was much smaller scale than the other ones they've done. Like, it's mostly a setup for next year's crossover, which they just straight up at the end of the third episode play a teaser for, and they're doing Crisis on Infinite Earths. That's next year's story. That's the whole thing. That's like the Monitor's whole role in the comics and in this, is that he is like testing different universes to see who's ready for the crisis, and they pass the test, but Oliver Queen might have like done something that means he's going to die at some point in the future. And so really the entire Elseworld story on this year's crossover, like I said, is kind of a setup, but it's just got so many fun elements. They're clearly like putting a lot of things in place with, because they are making a pilot for the Batwoman show with Ruby Rose, so they might, that might go to series as a full series, and I hope it does. She's a home run as that character, and the costume is so silly, and I love it. Like, it's got the red hair and everything.
Nice.
It's really good. And that was cool. And then you had all the stuff with Superman. We also met Lois Lane for the first time in this continuity, and that was fun. I want to see more of both of those characters on Supergirl. But just, I love these annual crossovers they do, because, you know, we have the, like, giant, big-budget apocalyptic crossovers in the Marvel Universe with the Avengers movies. But I like that we also get the kind of, like, low-rent CW network TV crossovers, where they're really, their big goal is to, like, have fun and get super comic booky. Like, if you think, like, yeah, Captain Marvel got pretty silly with, like, the Skrulls and the Kree and all of that stuff, and that was pretty comic booky. No, man. They used a book to rewrite reality in this three-parter I watched this weekend. That's silly, and I fucking loved it.
Nice.
Yeah. So anyway, I just like when they do these crossovers. I'm very curious what they're doing with Crisis on Infinite Earths next year, because if, from the comics, obviously that's a famous event where a bunch of characters die, and they collapse all of the multiverse into one Earth. And I'm not sure how they're going to handle it next year, but they have announced that Arrow, the TV series, is ending next season. And it's only going to be a 10-episode season, which means it would end when the crossover airs. So Arrow is probably going to end with Crisis on Infinite Earths. And it's hinted pretty heavily they're going to kill off Oliver Queen, which would be a fairly big deal, as he's like the first character in this. They call it the Arrowverse on CW because that's how it started. I do love that there's an entire universe with the CW superhero shows that, other than The Flash, is completely built on, like, I don't want to say B-list characters, but the characters who are like the opposites of the big characters you know. So instead of Batman, you have Arrow. Instead of Superman, you have Supergirl. Instead of Batman, we're going to have Batwoman. You know, instead of the Justice League, they have the Legends of Tomorrow, which is the team they made up out of characters that they didn't have another place for on the network. And it's just, they've made that such a great niche. I love that it's become as big as it is.
And I will just say, Green Arrow is a fucking, he's a C-list character. Like,
okay.
He's not even B-list. Like, Supergirl is B-list. Flash is probably, like, between B and A-list. Fucking Arrow. It's just the most hilarious part of all of this is that somehow this weird Green Arrow show that they don't even call him Green Arrow in.
They do now.
Okay, they do now. But like they don't. That at first it seemed like they were afraid to ever call him Green Arrow because it was sort of started around that time when all the DC movie stuff started. So it felt like, they're going for this dark, edgy Green Arrow thing and they're just calling it Arrow. And then eventually, it feels like I blinked and then all of a sudden there's a whole other, like, it just feels like, you know, in like eighth grade biology class when you take like the swabs and put it in the culture and then put it inside like a thing overnight and then you come back and study all the bacteria that's grown. I feel like that happened. Not in a negative way, but just as this, like, you look away and it's like, what the fuck? How did...
No,
there's like 10 shows all of a sudden and they have like 100 characters from the comics.
Yes.
Like Gorilla Grodd's, and it's like, How has all this happened?
They did a whole fucking two-parter in season 3 of The Flash where they go to the Gorilla Planet and all that with Gorilla Grodd. It's crazy.
Exactly. It's just like, it just feels like this happened in pop culture doesn't even know that it's there. Like, it's just the rest of society's going on and they didn't even know that this happened.
Because it's by far the most comic booky thing to come out of live-action comic book stuff is this, the Arrowverse. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, Arrow did start out as, like, CW wanted to do a Batman show, and they couldn't do Batman, so they got Green Arrow. And they even, because, like, the Arrow show even has the League of Shadows. Ra's al Ghul was a major villain on it. Like, the fucking Lazarus Pit was in there and was used on Black Canary, I think, at some point. Like, It's very funny to me that it basically is their replacement for Batman. Like, it's more of a Batman show than it frankly is a Green Arrow show, if you just compare it to the comics. And so they kind of have a field day with that in the episode of this crossover where they go to Gotham, and Green Arrow is, like, just insisting Batman is a myth. He's like, I was the original vigilante. There is no Batman. He's made up by the Gotham PD. And I just think they have fun with that because it's, you know, they're kind of the same character.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Who does Batman call in The Dark Knight Returns when he has to kill Superman with a kryptonite arrow? He calls Green Arrow. Of course he does.
Yes, he does.
Anyway. But yeah, Supergirl itself, like I said, is the show. Like, I'm going to make sure I catch up on The Flash before Crisis on Infinite Earths because I want to see how they tie all that together. Because The Flash is the show with the Infinite Earths and all that. I would love to watch all of Arrow before then. I don't know if I will have time because I'm like 6 seasons behind on that. But anyway, I just did want to say Supergirl continues to be really good. I said this last year when it went on mid-season break that Supergirl has had its best season yet, season 4. I've urged people, if you have never watched the show, just jump in with season 4. It's a really good jumping on point. It's an amazing season of television so far. It is, I think, doing a very good job of handling some pretty heavy social commentary and some fairly direct allegories in how it is talking about the Trump era and, like, the rise of fascism around the globe, while still being a very comic booky show, still having all of its character drama. They've also just made improvements, like the way they pared down the cast in between seasons 3 and 4 and, like, added some people, removed some people. The cast is better than it's ever been. They have all the characters positioned in more interesting places than they've been before. I think they've just really found a groove. It helps that they found, or they got new showrunners basically for this season, because if you didn't follow all this, Andrew Kreisberg, who was like the showrunner on Supergirl and The Flash and a bunch of other stuff, was Me Too'd a couple of years ago because he was sexually harassing everybody. And hey, not surprising when you get rid of the dude sexually harassing and like you have people who are actually devoting their time to the creative effort of the show and not harassing their staff members, the show does get better. So that helped. But anyway, the show has just focused in a lot more. And they've also, and in the episodes I've been watching, they've gotten into this more. Supergirl is kind of doing some trailblazing because it's introducing the first transgender superhero on television or in all of live action media, for what I know. I don't think a Hollywood movie has done that. But yeah, there's an actress named Nicole Maines who joined the cast this season. She's really young. She's like 21. She was a transgender activist before this. And I think this is her first like major acting role, but she's really, really good. She plays a character named Neil Null, who is a version of a character in the comics like Nora Null or something, who is, I think, a dude who becomes like Dreamer is the superhero name. And she becomes Dream Girl. But anyway, she starts out at Catco, where Kara works, Supergirl, and starts out as like a journalist. But then you find out she's an alien from another planet and has magical dream powers. And, you know, very comic booky. It's really good. They've done a lot of stuff to, like, not let her being trans be the only thing about the character. It's not at all. It doesn't get mentioned much at all. But it is, like, there. She is an openly transgender character. And in the episode I was just watching, where they really start to move into her getting superpowers, I think they have a very interesting treatment of it. Like, the whole mythology in her, like, alien culture, she's, like, half alien, half human, is that the women in her family line get these magical dream powers, and she has a sister, and when they were kids, it wasn't sure who was going to get those powers, but they assumed it was going to be the sister, because Nia is transgender, so she was born a boy. And I think the way they handle that has some really interesting content. There's some really good stuff with that character. I like that they're able to bring in another... This show has kind of had an overabundance of superheroes at times, but I think this one is worth the time, and they're having a lot of fun stuff there. And I also wanted to mention that Rachel Talalay, our favorite Doctor Who director, I don't know if you've noticed, Sean, she, since Doctor Who, has started doing a bunch of sci-fi television kind of all over the world. And she did an episode of Supergirl, which I watched the other night, and it was conspicuously well-directed, and I had to check who directed this, and I'm like, oh, that makes sense. This episode has an entire fight sequence in broad daylight with, like, invisible aliens, and it's actually really good. So, yay.
Give Rachel Talalay a big movie.
Yes.
Just give it to her.
Yes.
Give her a Star Wars or a Marvel or something. Just do it.
Yes. Rachel Talalay for the next Captain Marvel. That'd be great.
Fuck yeah.
Anyway. But yes, I just wanted to say my piece on Supergirl. It's still my favorite superhero show. It's really good. People should watch it. You know, that's all I have to say.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Sean, you want to do some news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
You are sighing because of our first news item, which just reads on my outline, Sonic the Hedgehog's live-action look is a fountain of bottomless horror. Did I sum it up well?
You summed it up very well, and you also, you know, did the courtesy of putting the image in the notes for the podcast. So I'm just looking at him.
Let's back up a second. There's a Sonic the Hedgehog live-action movie coming out this year, sadly.
Let's back up a second. There's a Sonic the Hedgehog live-action tragedy coming to theaters sometime this year.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's coming out in November. We had gotten the poster where we saw his furry little legs before, and that was kind of freaky, but, you know, reserving judgment. Then this week, the full look leaked because a film style guide leaked by a marketing department, and it has since been confirmed to be real. So we have our first look at Sonic the Hedgehog, and literally everything is wrong. It's kind of amazing that you could take a character who's very iconic and also just completely cinematic. Like, you really would not have to adapt Sonic that much to put him in a movie. And I know that because they've been putting Sonic next to human beings for fucking years in the TV shows and the video games and all that. And no, they very much changed his design. And it is terrifying. It will haunt my dreams forever.
It's just... Okay, Jonathan, what to you is, like, the single most offensive part of the character design?
Well, to quote Aunt May in the original Spider-Man, those eyes! Those horrible green eyes!
Yeah.
Yeah. They look like the kind of eyes you would see on a stuffed animal that are like the little plastic eyes that don't move and look dead and frozen. And Sonic has them and they're green. Sonic's eyes are not fucking green. And they just look wrong.
I mean, the main thing, probably the number one thing, is Sonic's traditional design is that he has, you know, because it's a fucking cartoon, he's kind of got one eyeball, sort of. His eyebrows don't, like, connect back down to, like, where his nose is, the way that most cartoon animal, like, anthropomorphic cartoon animals would be. They just kind of connect a little bit above it, and there's a little white space there. Just Google Sonic the Hedgehog, and you'll see what I'm talking about. But it's like, if you focus on it, it's technically like one big eye-looking thing. That obviously, when you read the character design normally, just looking at it, it reads as two different eyes. But you know, it's just a stylistic thing to make his eyes really big and expressive. And they decided not to replicate that element. And not only did they decide not to replicate that element, they didn't try to replace it with anything else. So instead of having like really big exaggerated eyes that still sort of connect and are like more traditional looking anthropomorphic animal eyes, but are still big and expressive with like long elongated pupils, instead they went for like normal sized eyeballs with like normal shaped pupils. And it's just not, it doesn't look like Sonic the Hedgehog. It looks like we went to like Taiwan and bought some like weird off-brand cereal that uses a character that's supposed to look like Sonic the Hedgehog, but doesn't exactly look like Sonic the Hedgehog enough so that they can't be sued. Right. It just doesn't, it's not Sonic. It doesn't look like him.
No.
The more you look at it, it doesn't fucking look like Sonic the Hedgehog to me.
No, and again, as I said before, I think what's so fucked up is that Sonic is not one of these, like, video game characters who I think needs this significant an adaptation to be in a movie in 3D. Like, his look is very cinematic. It's been manipulated a lot over the years. Like, I think his design in Sonic Boom, the video game and the TV show, I know the games get shit, the TV show is good. I love that look, where he's got, like, the bandana and everything. Like, it's different, but it's actually very, like, photogenic. You could have done something like that. It does not look like Sonic, but number two on my list, Sean, is definitely the white fur on his hands in place of gloves.
Yes, that's that, and that to me is maybe the worst, because it's the most insidious. Because it's just, it's so, that's the one that makes no sense to me. I can't, the more I grapple with it, the harder it is for me to come to terms with the fact that they just decided, instead of giving Sonic the Hedgehog white gloves, the way that like every cartoon character has white gloves, you know, Mickey Mouse, Mario, all of them do that. Instead of giving him white gloves, they decided to just give him white hands. And so his hands are, they're, you know, it's the same like sort of texture, like fur looking stuff that the rest of him has. It's just colored white inexplicably. And it's just so unnecessary, because I can, even if I like deeply, deeply disagree with almost every other character design choice, or I'll just say every other character design choice they made with this version of Sonic, I can understand why some like weird boardroom of like Hollywood execs would say, let's change the eyeballs and let's give him like a more like human looking musculature. It's gross and bad. I understand how they would get there. I don't understand how they get to, let's keep his hands white, but make them furry instead of just giving him white gloves. Why not just give him the fucking gloves?
Okay. I do not think this was their reason, because I don't think they thought this deeply about it. There is a legitimate argument against doing the white gloves, in so much as its origin is in minstrel shows. That is why cartoon characters have the gloves, is because minstrel shows, which is where blackface comes from, the traditional like blackface character would be the, you know, shoe polish on the face or whatever, the big lips, and then it would be big white gloves to do like the jazz hands with. And that is where it came from on Mickey, well, before Mickey Mouse, the like things Walt Disney did before that, and then Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse is a vaudeville minstrel show character, and then all other cartoon characters get that from that. Now, do I think that's actually the thought process that they went through with this? Probably not. If it was, I can understand maybe wanting to say, I don't like the gloves, I find it offensive. You can do something better than giving him very weird white hands that are supposed to look like he has natural glove fur. That's the weird thing. Like, you could have just given him, like, normal blue fucking hands. I don't think anyone would have noticed it. They'd be like, oh, there's no gloves. But whatever. That happens, you know? Like, Mickey Mouse has been gloveless in cartoons. It's weird.
Yeah, because it is. It's just the effect of when you glance over it, you don't notice. And so it's like, when I glance over it, my mind replaces the fur with gloves. But then when you focus on it, you're like, wait, no, they're not gloves. They're just weird white fur hands. And it's just,
It's even like, look where his knuckles are. They look like the raised knuckles on the gloves that are there, like, kind of for show. I don't know how his knuckles are that big. They're, like, bigger than his fucking fingers.
Yeah, it's rough. All right. And then he's just too furry. He's just too furry looking, and that's not... It's all just bad.
You can
it's
also all bad see... And gross. There are other angles of this this design in some of the other art that was leaked, and from the back... He's not just furry, he's spiny. Like, they made the spines look like actual, like, hedgehog porcupine spines. And I know his name is Sonic the Hedgehog, but I don't need him to look more like a hedgehog. No one has ever... The appeal of Sonic has never been the anatomical correctness of his hedgehog nature. It's very strange. Just the entire thing, it does not look good. Hollywood should not fucking be doing CGI of video game characters. I think the Detective Pikachu stuff looked weird enough, but at least then it is very faithful designs, just with lots of fur. This is not a faithful design with lots of fur. And yeah, I think your description of, like, this looks like something you'd go to fucking Singapore and find on a bootleg DVD, you know, oh my god. They could have done a photorealistic version of Sonic and it would have looked better.
It's just... fucking... I mean, you know, I didn't expect much better, but being faced with the reality of it is rough.
Now,
it's
Sean,
very rough.
Here's the real question.
Uh-huh.
We know Jim Carrey is playing Dr. Robotnik.
Uh-huh.
We don't know if Robotnik is CGI or live action. How scared are you for what Dr. Robotnik will look like? And would you be more or less scared if he was CGI or live action?
Oh, jeez. That's a hard question. Because I think, like... Either way, it's going to be bad. My gut says they're going to go with live-action Dr. Robotnik, so live-action Jim Carrey, and that is the right choice to make. Because, man, just trying to think about what fucking Dr. Robotnik... Although, maybe the greatest thing of all would be if it was a CG Dr. Robotnik, but it looked really good. Like, it looked like... Not even, like, modern Dr. Eggman, but, like... Like Sonic Mania, Dr. Robotnik / Eggman. Like, it's just like they somehow captured that design. That would be hilarious to me if somehow they got Dr. Robotnik fucking perfect and Sonic all wrong. Because you need to get that equation reversed. If there's one thing you need to get right, it's Sonic. If you fuck up Dr. Robotnik, that would probably be okay.
Yeah. So, okay, here's my next question, Sean. Hollywood has fucked up Sonic. We can say, visually at least, they have fucked up Sonic. Who knows about the movie?
I'll be prepared to eat these words if somehow Sonic the Hedgehog, the Hollywood movie, comes out. It's fucking amazing. I will just say right now, I feel pretty definitively they fucked everything up. I'm just going to say that.
This is not like Detective Pikachu, where it could be bad, but it looks pretty good. This is fucked up.
Yeah, I don't need to see the trailer yet to know this movie's not going to be good.
Okay. Illumination Entertainment, purveyors of such fine entertainment as the corporate Lorax movie and the corporate Grinch movie. They're making a Mario movie, Sean. Mm-hmm. Within like a year, we're going to have to do this for fucking Mario. How traumatic is that going to be? How bad are they going to fuck up Mario?
I'm really looking forward to the scene where Mario sticks his hands into chemicals and they just come out like scarred in white. Like fucking Joker hands, and that's how they don't have him wearing gloves, and so just have these just misformed, weird, white, bleached hands.
Oh my god. Okay. Let's move on. Sean, little report of something Microsoft is apparently planning to do before E3. Apparently Microsoft is planning what would be the first modern disc-free console. They are planning a disc-free Xbox One S for release this spring, so like by the end of May. The idea would be to get this under a $200 price point. The Xbox One S has multiple price points depending on the storage, but this would be the cheapest one yet, and it would be a completely digital Xbox One. I think this is kind of interesting because, you know, there have been constant predictions forever of when someone's going to do a disc-free console or a physical media-free console. The only one that I can ever remember actually pulling the trigger on it is the PSP Go did the thing where they got rid of the UMD disc drive inside the PSP, and that was an all-digital thing. But other than that, you know, the 3DS has always had carts, the Switch has carts, PlayStation, Xbox has always had discs, but this would be a disc-free Xbox One. What do you think about that?
I mean, it makes sense. Yeah, especially makes sense to roll out now that we're, like, you know, getting near the end of the Xbox One lifespan. You know, like, they, like, Microsoft is the one who's most sort of upfront with they are developing whatever the next, the successor to the Xbox One is going to be. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to put this out and get something out there at an even cheaper price point. I'm really curious to see what the design is going to be like how much they're kind of pushing it or expecting it to sell, or if it's going to be, like, I feel like you sometimes get those, like, really late day console revisions that end up being very cheap. Like, not just they are sold for cheap, but they are produced very cheap. Like, that late, like, the last version of the PS3 did not seem very good. And then there was, like, a late version Wii that also was just, like,
the Wii is bad. The best one because it was, like, only sold in Canada, and it was called the Wii. It was called the Wii Mini. And it ripped out internet connectivity. Like, it could not even get online. It could not, like, browse the eShop. It couldn't download anything. That is the worst offender, I think, probably.
Yeah. And so without having Microsoft actually, like, talking about it and putting something out official about it, it's hard to know how they're positioning it and what if it's going to be like, oh, no, this is, like, a totally reasonable, like, well-made thing that you sacrifice the Blu-ray drive, but it's cheaper. Or if it's just, like, here's this, like, super cheap console we can just push out before we're going to start, like, we're going to announce the Xbox 2 or whatever at E3 this year. I don't know which one of those it is.
Yeah, I have to say, if this is cheap enough, like, if this somehow came in at, like, $150, I might get it, because I have an Xbox One. I do use it from time to time. I own no physical media for my Xbox One. I had Halo the Master Chief Collection on disc at one point, and then the digital version was, like, $10 one day, and I was like, I will pay $10 to never have to put a disc in this thing again, you know? And I did that. And, you know, but the thing is, the Xbox One, I have a launch unit. It's fucking enormous. It's the biggest, like, console I've ever seen. It's got the giant power brick. If I could, like, you know, buy a cheap Xbox One and then sell this one and, like, pay less than $100 for it, I would do that. It would be a nice thing to have, especially if the Xbox One is kind of your supplemental console, which it is for me and I think a lot of people. I don't need a Blu-ray drive in it. I have other Blu-ray players. You know, if it was, like, nice and small and quiet, that would be a very nice supplemental gaming machine to have. I think it makes a lot of sense. I'm curious to see, you know, what specific role physical media plays in the next generation in general. I don't think either studio is going to be, or either company is going to be pulling out disc drives altogether, but I do wonder what role Blu-ray discs and things will be playing fully in the future, as we do have now games that come out and just literally none of the content on the disc is used and they're just completely patched over day one. That happens from time to time. You know, so it's interesting to me. And this makes sense, especially for Microsoft, because they are trying to push their subscription service so hard. I can imagine that they will be selling this in a bundle with, like, 2 years of Game Pass or something. And it will just, you know, the whole idea is you buy this and it's almost like an Apple TV for gaming or something, and you buy a subscription and play shit. So, yeah, it's interesting to me. And like I said, interesting to see someone finally pull the trigger on that on a home console, because it seemed kind of unkillable before the disc drive.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense, though. It's definitely because I'm with you. I think there are some people who are looking at this, and I've seen comments on the internet and stuff being like, oh, this means the discs are a thing of the past, and we're just like, no, you fucking, like, still the vast majority of sales of games are still physical. Like, the gap is getting bigger. Digital sales are getting bigger and bigger every year, but the majority of sales are still physical discs. And I think people sometimes overlook that because they only buy digital and their friends only buy digital, but lots of people buy video games.
Yes. This is also actually still true of movies, I believe. The DVDs still outsell, you know, digital sales. Physical media is bigger than people realize, especially if you live in, like, a nice big city with good internet and don't realize the need for a lot of rural or just not giant urban areas, you know, where people are just naturally going to prefer physical media. Like, you know, I live in Iowa. There's a Redbox on every fucking corner, Sean. They're mm-hmm. everywhere. And I actually like them because I get, like, I can just wait a couple months and then I'm like, I want to buy Mission Impossible Fallout on Blu-ray and it's $2 used and I just buy it and I never have to return it. It's great. Anyway.
There you go.
All right. That was a bit of a tangent. Let's see. Okay, two Nintendo pieces of news. One is Nintendo Labo is not dead, and they announced the Labo VR kits. They're going to do a couple of these kits. It's, you know, you build yourself a little pair of goggles out of cardboard, and you put your Nintendo Switch in it, and then you look very, very closely at your Nintendo Switch, and there's also, like, some toys, and there's, like, a gun that you stick on the front of it. It kind of seems like, you know, the general idea of VR mixed with all the, like, NES accessories, like, you know, the Super Blaster and things like that. I guess that would be Super NES. But, yeah, it's kind of odd, and I do have to say, Sean, remember when we mm-hmm. were kids and our parents would scold us for sitting too near the TV?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What the fuck's going on? How is it okay to just... Maybe that was all a lie. Maybe sitting close to the TV did not hurt your eyes. I'm not a scientist. But now we're just routinely being told to strap a fucking screen onto our eyes. Like, you have the fucking... Samsung has the thing that you do with, like, the cell
your
phone
VR.
And that creates VR. Nintendo's just like, here, put your fucking Switch in a piece of cardboard and look right at it on your eyes. I don't know how that's good for you, because I was raised very differently. I feel old.
Yeah, like, I've never quite known, I've never done the research to know if all the, like, only watch things with the lights on and stay, like, 5 yards away from your TV and watch it through binoculars, you know, like, because there was definitely a movement like that. I don't know if that's actually a thing or not, and if that is something you need to do. I do, man, like, is looking at the Labo VR stuff, the fucking, the box art for, like, the box they have, which has all these kids looking through the different things, and there's, like, one that has, like, an elephant face on them, and then there's one that's just looking through a bird's asshole, and it's just, man, I don't, there's something that I saw this, I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, what, you're just, like, putting a Switch inside a little VR thing that's shaped like a bird and then sticking it right in your face and just staring at this fucking, like, 720p screen right in front of you. I just can't imagine that that's going to look very good.
So here's the thing. The only time I've ever used VR in my life is my brother, when he has, I think, an LG phone. It's one of those Android phones. And like a lot of Android phones now, it's an OLED screen. It's, like, above 1080p. You know, it's a really good screen, right? Mm-hmm. And he got sent, because he bought the phone, a free... I forget what the kind of VR thing it is, but it's like one of those Samsung or someone, like, makes those VR things where it's like a pair of goggles and you put the phone in and the phone does the VR. And he, like, loaded it up and used it for about 5 minutes and was like, this is terrible. And I'm like, can I see it? And loaded it up and did, like, one of the VR YouTube videos that's supposed to be like you're under the sea and, like, looking around. Sean, it was the blurriest, shittiest looking thing I've ever seen. The 3D on my Nintendo 3DS, which is 10 years old and is a 240p screen, is miles better and more immersive. And I was watching this through, you know, an AMOLED, you know, 2260p or whatever the fuck resolution it is screen right up against my eyes. What the hell does that... I love the Nintendo Switch. It's this little 720p display. It's not built for that. How does it do 3D? 3D is fairly important for VR. I don't really understand that part of it whatsoever. Yeah, I mean, I know it's for kids and kids are less discerning, but I do not get it.
Yeah, I'm just having a very hard time imagining. I mean, you know, obviously it's not something where they're not marketing this of like, oh, you're going to be playing like VR fucking Super Mario Odyssey or something. It seems like they're saying, this is like little Labo games. They're its own little tiny thing, and you make the elephant face or whatever put on your face, and you pretend you're an elephant or whatever the fuck that kid's doing, and stomp around the house and go, I don't know. And so if it's just like little tiny things, like maybe you can then scale it in such a way that it's decent enough, but it is just really hard for me to imagine like taking this like big bulky screen, but that is also 720p. So it's like a not very high resolution, particularly for the size of the screen relative to what we're used to today, and sticking that right in front of your face in a little cardboard thing and stomp around. And again, like it's, you know, I haven't had much like personal hands-on experience with the Switch, but the Switch seems bulky and heavy enough to be a kind of thing that you don't want just strapped on your face all the time, especially if you're a little kid. Like,
yeah,
if
how
you're
many
like
switches
seven
are gonna
or
break
eight
because of this, right?
Yeah, their switches are going to break, or they're fucking, they're going to just, you know, when they're 50 years old, they're going to really regret all those long Switch VR sessions when their fucking neck is just like broken and sore, and like their neck muscles aren't right because they just had this big heavy thing on their face all the time.
You know, I love the Switch. I think its screen is perfect for how you normally play it, which is not right up against your eyes. I think its proportions are perfect for how you play it, which is usually in two hands or in the dock, not strapped to your face. It just feels like there is a limit to where, like, you know, I also love my TV, but I don't want to strap that thing to my fucking face. Sean, here's my other piece of confusion with this. This is Nintendo. Let's do a little more direct than just our parents telling us not to stare at the TV for too long. This is a 3DS game. This is Dragon Quest VIII, or VII. I just pulled this off the shelf. I have a bunch of 3DS games over here. This is a relatively recent one. Every 3DS game since the inception of the system in 2011 has had this little warning on the bottom, which is 3D is for ages 7 and up. It's dangerous for your eyes. They had to put that on there because there's no scientific evidence for it, but parents were really afraid of their kids looking at the glasses-free 3D thing. We have come a long way from these warning labels, which are still on games you go buy in stores, to we're going to sell you some cardboard and tell you to strap the fucking thing to your face. What happened, Sean?
Yeah, I remember, like, these people must still exist, but I remember there, it used to be a thing you'd hear where there's people who thought, like, no, all the fucking radio waves of the cell phone is giving you fucking brain cancer. It's like, you're just holding this thing up to your face all the time. And it's like, that was all nonsense and dumb shit.
Oh, we don't know, like, that yet. I'm kidding.
No,
I'm
that
kidding.
Was not. Yeah, that was fucking. Yeah, radio waves cause our fucking brains to have cancer. Fucking idiots. But yeah, now we're just like strapping fucking screens to our faces, like just idiots, like just little idiots, and like staring into cardboard goose butts.
It's just VR is like the thing where I feel like an old person the most, where I can't wrap my head around it really. But I think I could wrap my head around like the PlayStation VR. It's the cardboard and stick your Switch in it that really confuses me.
Yeah, like, I think maybe here's the thing for me, is that, like, the super high-end, high-tech VR stuff still feels like it's not there yet, and we're still, like, working to get that to be, like, a viable, like, you know, vibrant market. And so since we haven't even gotten that there yet, it feels way too soon to have the fucking shitty cardboard version that everyone's using. Like, it just feels like we haven't gone through the proper cycle right. Like, it would be like if they released this sub-$200 Xbox One S and it was, like, the crappy version, like that Canadian Wii or whatever. It'd be like if that came out a month after the Xbox One came out instead of at the end of the console life cycle, right? It's just we're getting this started, guys. We can't just get all the cardboard gooses out yet. We need to wait until the, like, big, very, like, the fucking $800 version works perfectly. Once that's done, then you can sell the cardboard goose.
All right. Do you think this will be more or less successful than the Virtual Boy?
More successful than the Virtual Boy.
Because it's the Switch.
Yes, because it's the Switch, because it's cheaper.
It will have probably more games at launch than the Virtual Boy had its entire 3-month lifespan.
Yeah, it's, you know, the Virtual Boy was a dire, sad thing that Nintendo has forgotten, and rightly so.
All right. I'm going to skip this next news item just because I feel like it's more than I want to take on right now, and I want to make sure we move along and get to Captain Marvel. But I want to do this last one, which is Disney, fucking Disney, which we're going to talk about in a minute with Captain Marvel. We generally, you know, we like a lot of their movies, but they have too much money, and they want even more money. We already played an entire game on our 2019 Year in Preview podcast about how many fucking big movies Disney had this year and what a ridiculous amount of money they're going to make. And Disney decided, you know what? Not enough money. Not enough movies. And they moved up the sequel to Maleficent, which nobody knew was being made. I mean, I'm sure somebody did, but I sure as shit didn't. And they took it out of 2020 and they put it into the middle of October 2019. And that is very strange, especially because usually you do that if you don't have, like, a busy fiscal year and you want to get more money onto the calendar because you feel like you would underperform. Disney's not going to underperform this year, so this is a very strange move. Also, there's a Maleficent sequel. That's weird.
Yeah, no, that it just happened. I don't know when they made that movie.
No, no one does. Okay, the real reason I'm bringing this up is because we played the game on the 2019 Year in Preview podcast, where I predicted the box office of all the Disney movies, and they added another movie, so I have to predict the box office of Maleficent 2, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I've added
No, but yes.
Okay. So I've added it to my list, and I am estimating a worldwide box office for Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, which is the name of the movie. I'm predicting a worldwide box office of $432 million. Where do I get that number? The first film grossed $758.5 million. I know, that's strange. That's a lot of money for a movie about the villain from Sleeping Beauty, but it did gross a lot of money. The most recent comparison would be Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass, because those are the most recent Disney live-action remakes that had a sequel, right? And the second one really flopped. Alice Through the Looking Glass only grossed 30% of Alice in Wonderland 1. Now, I don't think Maleficent 2 is going to have that big a drop, because that would be weird. So I decided, let's look at some other comparisons over the years that would help us with Disney. And I found two that happened to have the exact same multiplier between sequels. So this is what I did. You have the two Glenn Close 101 Dalmatian films. There was 101 Dalmatians in the 90s, and then there was 102 Dalmatians in the 2000s. And then you also had, remember, they did those Chronicles of Narnia movies, and they did Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then Prince Caspian. Each of those movies had sequels that grossed exactly 57% as much as the original, and I found that statistic so striking, I just applied the exact same calculation here, and if this movie grosses 57% of the first one, it would be $432 million, and that seems about right to me.
I think that math checks out. So what's our new estimated total with these new numbers put in, Jonathan?
$11.909 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm pretty confident I'm close on that one, and I'm also pretty sad that I'm not getting any of that money.
Yeah, I think this is probably pretty accurate, because, Jonathan, do you want to know the trailers that I saw in front of Captain Marvel?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, so I saw a trailer for Dumbo, which is a Disney movie. I saw a trailer for Spider-Man Far From Home, which is a Disney movie.
It's not. That's Sony, technically.
Well, but it's...
Disney sees no money from that.
Okay, but it's so they don't have money, but they have mind share, and it will make the money in the future.
Sure.
So it is, in as far as I'm concerned, it's effectively a Disney movie. Even if they're not going to see the money specifically from that, it ultimately is going to contribute to their overall portfolio, and the wider public sees it as a Disney movie.
That's fair.
But, yes. And then there's The Lion King, which that's a fucking Disney movie. Then there's fucking the new X-Men movie, which is going to ultimately be some Disney, I don't know, whatever the fuck, all that shit's going to work out with Fox, but Disney's buying Fox. That merger is almost through. So that is in some way now a Disney movie. And then Shazam, which was the only one that was like objectively not a Disney movie. And it was like, I was just sitting there watching, it's like, fuck, these are all Disney or Disney like related movies in some way, except for Shazam, which is still a superhero movie, but at least it's somebody else. And it was just like, oh my God. I just watched through all the trailers for these movies.
I do want to say I was definitely wrong on Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel is not out of theaters yet. It's only been 3 days. But in its first 3 days worldwide, it did $500 million. It's one of the biggest launches for a film ever worldwide. And I had Captain Marvel pegged at $700 million, thinking it would fall somewhere on the Doctor Strange end of things. It's not. It's going to fall on the Guardians of the Galaxy end of things. I actually think there's a pretty good chance Captain Marvel hits $1 billion. Movies do not open in the United States at $150 million and not make $1 billion worldwide. So I definitely lowballed Captain Marvel. It's possible I highballed something else on the list, like The Lion King, but I don't know. I don't feel good ever lowballing a Disney movie, because they always just somehow make more money than you think they're going to make.
Yeah, it's frightening. And I did also find it endlessly amusing to be sitting in a movie theater and seeing a trailer for a movie featuring a character that I know to be Captain Marvel, but has been renamed Shazam, which is playing in front of a movie for Captain Marvel. I was just like, where the fuck? Like, it was just, I had this moment where it's like, what the fuck is this world we live in? Like, how have I gotten here? If you went back in time and told my, like, 10-year-old self how all, like, that this would happen, that I'd be watching the Captain Marvel trailer in front of the Captain Marvel trailer, but the first, or the Captain Marvel movie, but the Captain Marvel trailer can't be Captain Marvel because of the Captain Marvel movie, so it's just called fucking Shazam. It's like, how the fuck is this my life? How is this where we are, Jonathan?
So Zachary Levi, who plays Captain Marvel in the Shazam movie, he is not Carol Danvers. He's Billy Batson. Zachary Levi was on the Rooster Teeth podcast last week. They did an interview with him, and Zachary Levi's a fun guy. I like listening to him. But at one point, he slips and calls the character Captain Marvel. And someone on the podcast gets confused. And so poor Zachary Levi, who did not sign up for this, had to tell the story of why it's not called Captain Marvel and what that whole thing is. It is amazing. In like 3 minutes, he tries to do the really complicated legal history of why their movie is called Shazam. And it's hilarious, and I loved that. And I also want to say, I think that movie looks really good. I'm looking forward to Shazam.
Yeah, I thought the trailer played pretty well.
Yeah, it also premiered the other night, and people are loving it from what I've seen. So I think it looks like a fun movie. I was not sold on it at first, as you would have heard on this podcast, but I've come around to it. And, you know, I think DC's had some good movies lately, and I hope this is one of them. It would be great if we got two good Captain Marvel movies in a month, Sean.
Maybe we can have the fated Captain Marvel crossover, Captain Marvel versus Shazam, Dawn of Justice.
All right. Well, we've said it enough. Let's talk about it. Captain Marvel, Sean, the DC one, who is just, there's no other name. It's just, well, it was Ms. Marvel at one point, so there are other names. Never mind. This movie, she's Captain Marvel. She's Carol Danvers, which also confuses me because Supergirl is Kara Danvers. Anyway, there's too much crossover here. Let's talk about Captain Marvel with Miss Brie Larson, directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, and written by 50 different people. It does have a lot of talented people, but clearly this went through a couple drafts. So we said earlier we thought this one's good, maybe middle-tier Marvel. I would put it personally above a Doctor Strange or the first Ant-Man. I would say maybe this falls in the same general area as like the first Thor to me, which is that like I think it's fun, it's got some really unique elements. Maybe the script isn't in its strongest piece, but also you walk away being like, that person is a star. And in this case, it's Brie Larson. In that case, it was Chris Hemsworth. Where do you want to start with this movie?
Let's start with Captain Marvel. Let's start with the character herself, because that's, like I said at the top of this podcast, in its own weird way, like that's how these movies work. That's how this business works, is you have to sell people on the character first and foremost. Because that's who you need to be able to have for the crossovers and the sequels and everything else. And so the most important thing that they do in this movie is they 100% nail this version of this character. And it's interesting because we're back in the territory of Marvel comic book movies where I personally don't have a huge amount of familiarity with the character, right? So this is like a Guardians or sort of Ant-Man. Like, I know Ant-Man more from Hank Pym than Scott Lang. So I'll count Ant-Man in there also of like, we have gone far enough from the core Marvel thing that I don't have a huge familiarity with it. And specifically all the stuff they pull for her in this movie feels like stuff that is outside what I know from Ms. Marvel / Captain Marvel, because I know the character more as Ms. Marvel from the comics, because her being called Captain Marvel is more of a recent thing.
And I'm not a comics person to begin with, but there are plenty of characters I know through the grapevine, you know? This mm-hmm. definitely falls in the area of, like, the Guardians of the Galaxy for me, where I would not have known any of this stuff going in. I knew nothing about Captain Marvel. I couldn't have told you a Skrull from a Kree. I practiced that before this podcast so I wouldn't make the fucking mistake and call them Skrees and Krulls or whatever, because Krull is also a fucking sci-fi thing. Anyway, yeah, so I knew nothing. That was actually fun for me, was because I feel like this probably was for me also like the Marvel movie where I knew the least about the source material going in. And so there was a lot of discovery, and they play on that. Like, this one has like the most like genuine twist I've seen in a Marvel movie, where like, I don't know if I want to say I didn't completely see it coming, because by the time it happens, like, they're preparing you for it, but like, it genuinely played against expectations. But yeah, anyway, you were talking about the character. I agree. I think they got the character mostly. The thing is, I think the character is great. I think the performance is even better. I do think the script is mm-hmm. so busy with things to do. Like, this is by far the most complicated origin story they've told. Because it is not a simple linear, you know, we don't start with Carol Danvers in the 80s becoming a cool fighter pilot, and then the crash happens. They do it all out of order. Like, the movie, the main driving force of the film is the mystery about who she is and where she came from. That's a tricky thing to do. I think stories where you make the main character also the main mystery can be problematic. A good example for this podcast, Sean, is season 7 of Doctor Who with Clara. Clara would go on to be a great Doctor, the greatest modern companion on Doctor Who. But in that first season, you'd never really got a feel for her as a character because she was also the central mystery. I felt a little bit of that with Captain Marvel, where I do feel like the movie is so busy with world building It's got so many plot elements going on. There was not an extended chunk of time where I felt like I was just getting to know the character. Ultimately, I think Brie Larson is good enough, and the story, especially in the second half, is good enough that it didn't bother me that much. But I also can't say I walked out of this feeling like I knew her as well as I knew Steve Rogers after Captain America or Tony Stark after the first Iron Man, because those movies do have extended periods of time that are really just about getting to know the character. This is literally from moment one, she is on the mission, on the run, doing action, and you get to know her through that. And I think a lot of that works, but for me, I also felt like maybe there was something missing where I wanted to have more quiet moments where I saw what makes this character tick, because sometimes those are my favorite moments in Marvel movies.
No, yeah, I absolutely agree, because I think it's mostly the performance in like the core conceit of the character works really well. But I think they let the character down a bit in, I think for me, probably the number one thing is that they hold off too long to get to that twist. And so this is full spoiler territory. So like the twist of the movie being that you're set up to think that the Skrulls are the bad guys, but it's actually the Kree who Captain Marvel is fighting for are actually really the bad guys, and the Skrulls are just refugees. And like, I think that's a strong twist. It works well for the movie, and it works well as someone who is a Marvel fan, because it's not something I was really expecting. And we'll get more into detail of like, I think how they play some of those expectations on who is Mar-Vell and like, what is the role of the Kree and the Skrull in this movie. But they pull that twist, which I think is a solid twist, but it takes so long to get there that you, by the time you get there, you don't have anywhere near enough time with Carol Danvers, who knows who she is and has like a like clear, like proper motivation in the movie. Because for so long of the movie, her motivation is misaligned with like what really is supposed to be going on. And so it keeps like us, I think, like away from the character. And there's a distance between us and her because of the whole like amnesiac stuff and not really, and having to be coy with her background on stuff that we like, obviously, you know, from like immediately that she's not actually Kree, that she is actually human, but they still have to play coy with that for a long time because the character doesn't know that yet. But then they have to play coy with everything around the Kree and the Skrull to pull off the twist, and that stuff is fine. But I think it would have been more fine if it was contained to the first act, or like in maybe like the first half of the second act at most. Instead, it feels like that stuff happens at the end of the second act, and like the movie's almost over at that point.
I feel that. I wouldn't want to completely restructure this movie, because I think the idea of starting with her as a Kree soldier, not knowing who she is a compelling one. Mm-hmm. But I do think you could reorder it somewhat. Like, you know, like the reason Captain America, the first Avenger, will always be my favorite of the Marvel origin stories. I guess it depends on how you classify Black Panther, which isn't, it's a first movie, but it's not an origin story, blah, blah, blah. But in terms of true blue origin stories, the original Captain America, is you have that 30 minutes or whatever it is at the top where it's skinny CGI Steve Rogers, and it is almost purely getting to know this man, getting to know his motivations, and when he becomes the superhero, you know him really well. And I feel like that's a great model for an origin story. It's why Steve Rogers is probably my favorite character in the MCU in terms of the main heroes. With this, I feel like I wanted something like that. You know, they start with her having a dream. And I do think there may have been a mistake in having the opening scene of the movie be like the crash, like the key mystery element. I feel like the first scene should have been something on Earth, like her talking with her friend. Like, because we never get to know that friend she has on Earth very well, except in these like little, you know, vestigial flashbacks, when they actually meet, I did not feel like the pull there. I feel like there should have been something like that, and she wakes up not knowing if that was her actual life or not, and then you could go on with it. Because the bookend of that is, I feel like one of the clunkier scenes in terms of writing is when she's kidnapped by the Ben Mendelsohn Skrull, I forget his name, and he's poking through her memories, and we jump through like her entire life. That is one of the clunkiest pieces of writing in the MCU. Like, it just, it has to do, like, the first 30 minutes of Captain America on fast forward, and it feels very awkward to me. And I feel like you could have distributed that a little more to give us that kind of human core with the character. Because otherwise, I don't know, it just feels a little weightless to me.
Yeah, and it's something where, because I'm like, trying to think of, like, other ways you could play around with it. And it's something of, they could have, you know, just gone so far as you don't need to make the flashbacks diegetic. You don't need to make them something that a character is experiencing. Like, it would be, you know, you have to give the audience a certain amount of credit to be able to understand what you're doing. But if you just fade it to black and came up and it was some like thing that happened in the past, like for, I'm thinking of specifically the Extremis episode of Doctor Who, where you have the parallel plot line of what's going on with the Master being potentially executed in the past, and then all the shit going on with the Doctor in the present in that episode. And there's like, that episode doesn't even have any tangible, like, clear plot connection to those two things at all. It's just entirely thematic. And if they had maybe been a little bit more ambitious in that sense and played around with that, you could have conveyed the communication about, like, of information about the character in a way that doesn't have to be like so plot. You don't have to move so many plot pieces to get it to happen. Because I think you're 100% right. The one of the main issues with the movie is that by the time Carol Danvers becomes like Carol Danvers and meets up with her friends and starts getting her memories back, for us, there's no sense of, oh, this is who she's supposed to be. Like, she's back to who she's supposed to be, because we don't know who that is, because we've never seen that. And having, being able to sort of bridge that gap, I think, is really important, so that the audience can experience that sense of, oh, she has, you know, she is like on the right path and she is who she's supposed to be now.
It's the danger of tying like character revelations and just basic character traits into plot heavy, you know, exposition and things like that, because the two kind of cancel each other out in a weird way, where the plot, I think, feels too convoluted in the movie and the character work feels too diluted. I think all the good stuff is there for both. I think this movie has a fun story and it's got a really good central character. I just think the way they combine them does feel a little like it dilutes both of them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the sequence in the movie that for me is most illustrative of the Captain Marvel, maybe as a movie as a whole, because it's effective in a lot of ways, but you can also see how it doesn't get the way all the way it needs to be, is the montage at the end of the movie when she gets knocked down and she's getting back up, and it plays all these sequences of her throughout her life getting up from all these other things. And it's a really effective moment with how it's staged and presented in that moment in and of itself. It is so well made and edited and put together. And it's like a really powerful climax for the movie, but it feels somewhat neutered by the fact that we've never seen her get up at any of those other moments. We've all like, and I get the thing of them being like, we're said, like you see a number of the different setups for those. Like you see the fall before she gets up a couple of times in like weird disjointed flashbacks, but those moments don't feel like, and at that time they're building up to this climactic moment of her, like, this is what I've always do. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, I'm always going to get back up when I get shoved down.
Yeah.
Like, that's just such a powerful message, but it could have been built up to so much more effectively.
I agree. I think it's a great scene at the end of the film, but now that I'm thinking about it, 100% the first scene of this movie needed to be a thing where she gets knocked down and gets up. Like, that has to be the opening. That has to be the prelude. I'm even thinking, like, Marvel likes to do this thing now where they open without the studio logos and do, like, an opening scene and then do the logos, you know? That's what they should have done here, is have, like, a scene as her of a kid or something and have the standing up and then go into the logos and then have her as a Kree on the Kree planet. Like, because I agree. I think that we needed to really know that that's part of her character visually, you know, not just have all these things kind of in the back of our minds that don't fully stick because they don't stay with them that long, I didn't think. Yeah, I agree with that. You know what it feels like to me, like, and I'm a little extra critical of these sort of things right now because I am in a screenwriting class here at Iowa, and you know we're doing exercise. You know we're doing like full long form feature screenplays, and one of the exercises we did was you'll see this in a lot of writers' rooms where you write the whole plot out on cards and like you put them on the wall and try to order the plot. This feels like a movie where the cards just aren't quite aligned to me, where like all the different plot points on the cards I really like and I think they're really good. It just feels like they didn't quite nail the order, and that's why I say it feels like a first or second draft of the screenplay, because there's also kind of a lot of herky jerkiness, especially in the first half, of like, okay, we're on Kree, then we're going to go on the mission, then after the mission she gets kidnapped and does all the memories, and then she escapes and gets to Earth, and then she meets Fury, and she and Fury drive here, and then they go here, and it's very episodic, and it feels like getting them from A to B to C sometimes is more of a hurdle than they want it to be. It doesn't completely flow smoothly. Now, this is not a completely new problem to comic book movies or to MCU movies. Like, Doctor Strange is much worse at this, I think, if, in terms of like getting from A to B to C. But I just, you feel like the lack of fluidity there, that is definitely there in something like a Black Panther or something. That is also similarly a complex plot that takes you all over the world, but I don't think you feel the cogs turning as much.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. But we're talking about negatives. Why do we love Carol Danvers so much? I mean, let's talk about Brie Larson's performance. Like, what does shine through? Like, we say the writing could maybe make the character clearer, but I think we both agree by the end we really like this character and want to see more of her. And I think, like I said, the best descriptor I can give is she is giving, like, the best Saturday morning hero performance you could ask for. And that could sound like a criticism, but I don't mean it that way. It is a big, broad performance, and beautifully so. Like, that sort of thing can be really good. And other MCU heroes have given something like this, like a Chris Hemsworth, where, like, I think she's, you know, doing, like, she has some of the jokiness with, like, she's a fairly sarcastic character, and that's very fun. Brie Larson is just very good in that mode. It's clearly, I think, her personality if you watch interviews with her. But also, like, when moments of, like, heroism comes, it's the same kind of thing you get with a Steve Rogers or a Thor, where I really like the kind of purity of it and the kind of broad comic booky Saturday morning approach, which is simplistic in some ways, but I also think takes a lot of skill to pull off, and she pulls it off.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just the character exudes this, like, really powerful confidence
mm-hmm.
that I love. And it's something that probably the other character that is most like that is also Thor. Mm-hmm. That there's a certain, like, degree of just sheer confidence in the performance and then that the character itself exudes in the movie. And yeah, and it's just like she's always so sure of herself and is always trying to do the right thing. And I also particularly love her relationship with the little kid of her best friend. I think that's one of the most important little pieces of the movie, is it shows that it's not just that she, like, you know, she's always trying to do the right thing. That she is a very kind person also. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like adding that little touch in there is kind of what, like, seals it for me. Because otherwise, she feels like a little bit too much of, like, a stereotypical, like, Marine lady, kind of like Army lady kind of performance. And having that little extra, like, compassion or empathy or whatever it is she has with, like, that connection she has with some of those characters makes her feel more specifically superheroic in a way I really like. And like you said, it feels like a Saturday morning cartoon kind of character in a good way, that there is this, like, true heroism to her that she's not a Hulk or she's not an Iron Man. That's, like, what makes her very interesting are the, like, the little flaws. What makes her interesting is her, like, unerringness. So she's a little bit more on, like, the Captain America or Superman side of how you construct a superhero character.
She feels like, and I guess if I were to try to put this into cleaner words than what I had before, she feels like someone meant to be looked up to. Like, at any age you watch the movie, she is, you know, like a good hero in some things aimed at kids, she's someone you want to look up to and learn from, and they can be kind of an idol. And I like that, and it's a good performance in that way. And I think there's two key things that make it. It's the confidence, which you said, absolutely, 100%. It's also the joy. It's a really joyful performance. Like, Brie Larson is clearly having a ton of fun on screen, and that is a key thing for a movie like this. Like, she is, you know, taking this opportunity to do this, you know, giant $200 million movie and being like, and I'm going to have a party with it, you know? And I think there is that kind of palpable sense of joy in the performance and in using the powers and in getting to fight and things like that. And it's not to say she doesn't get serious in certain moments when the movie calls for it, but, you know, I always love it in superhero movies when someone gets powers and instead of being like, oh, these powers, what is the burden of these powers? It's like, oh, hey, I can, like, punch people with my fist and, like, energy comes out. That's fucking cool. I like that.
Yeah, and they also just, like, she is the most powerful hero in the MCU. I mean, her only competition is Thor, and the shit she does in this movie is more impressive than anything Thor has done. Other than, like, maybe a little bit of, like, Thor in Avengers Infinity War, like, forging the fucking super hammer or whatever. Like, that's pretty cool. But yeah, she's just...
Captain Marvel tears through a fucking fleet.
Yeah, she goes to reference some Gundam, she goes full fucking Amuro on their asses and just destroys, like, five battleships, and it's like, fucking, yeah, okay, cool, just blow it all up, awesome.
I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, all the different connections to other Marvel movies, particularly Guardians of the Galaxy, but I think it's a very sly thing to bring in Ronan the Accused in this film and have him be kind of the big bad at the end, because we spent an entire movie, Guardians of the Galaxy, with these guys trying to beat this one guy, and they don't even beat him at the end. They just are able to, like, hold on to the Infinity Stone a little bit longer. And with this, it's like she tears through Ronan's entire fucking fleet, and Ronan retreats. And it's like, if Captain Marvel had been in pretty much any of the other Marvel movies, there would have been no problems. There would have been no conflict. That's a good way to establish the power of a character. Even though it does beg the inevitable questions about what Nick Fury was doing with that goddamn phone for the last, like, 20 movies.
But, you know, Captain Marvel's dealing with a different fucking scale of bullshit
yes.
than what's going on Earth. It's like, she's dealing with some intergalactic nonsense. She was busy.
I'm just saying, that invasion in Avengers 1 seemed pretty scary, and Nick Fury was, like, really betting on these four assholes getting their deal together in the first Avengers, and, like, you know, being able to beat all these aliens, and he did have a get-out-of-jail-free card in his back pocket he could have used.
For all we know, he did, and she was busy, you know? She was fighting an intergalactic space worm or some bullshit.
Oh, you know how they...
We don't know what she was doing.
You know how they used to do on the Marvel Blu-rays, the little shorts, like the short movies? Mm-hmm. I want, on the Avengers Endgame Blu-ray, a series of just... You can just shoot these on green screens with the two actors, but get Sam Jackson and Captain Marvel, and it's at various points in the Avengers movies where he is calling her up, and whatever crazy excuse she has of, like, I'm sorry, that Ultron thing sounds really bad, but I cannot come right now. And, like, her just under, like, unbelievable pressure out in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. Because that would be a fun way to close that particular plot gap. I don't think it's a plot hole. It's just a plot gap.
Yeah, I think it's you know, it's just the superhero thing of they were busy.
Of
There's
course,
lots of
yeah.
shit going down. Whenever they don't show up, it's because they're always busy.
Yes. Anyway, that would be fun. Anywho, yes, so we like Captain Marvel. Do you want to talk about some of the other characters in this film or the Marvel, like, references? We just mentioned all the... I actually want to hit that first, just because it's easy to get out of the way. Were you surprised at how much it was drawing in on, like, particularly stuff from Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, I thought, because I had just kind of totally forgotten that Ronan the Accuser was the villain of the first Guardians movie, and that he's a Kree, which is true of his character in the comics. And so when he showed up, I'm like, oh, right, shit, Ronan, right, this dude. Because, you know, he was, you know, one of those Marvel movie villains that, utterly forgettable, not in any way the point of the movie that he's in. He just has to be a thing that the heroes have to be join up together to defeat at the end.
He's more entertaining than this than he was in his first movie.
Yeah, because none of the weight of anything is on him. So yeah. He just gets to be there and be like, I get to look cool because I'm holding a hammer. What looks real cool.
But you
and
also,
it's like, that's all you need from him.
Yep. You also get on the Kree team that Captain Marvel is a part of, the Jimin Honsu character, who's the guy who, like, is in all the trailers for the first Guardians of the Galaxy going, who? When Star-Lord says his name. I thought that was an interesting connection, having him there. And I feel like I should have seen the twist that the Kree are bad earlier on, because they were very clearly, like, planting all these characters who were villains in the other movies being in the ranks of Captain Marvel's team. But I was just like, ah, that's weird that there's all these villains in the Kree. But the Kree are good. They told me they were.
Yeah, it's like, I knew that the Kree are kind of assholes, but not... And from what I remember the comics, they're never, like, explicitly villainous. They're just like... And they're like a hyper-advanced warrior race that has their own agenda that is not always aligned with the humans.
Yeah.
But then you also have the Tesseract stuff, which at this point, I just don't remember. I need to go back and watch Avengers 1, like the original Thor. I just don't remember where the Tesseract has been or not. Like, because my gut when that happened was like, does that work with how what we knew before? Because I just can't... it hasn't... You know, that Thor 1 came out when I was in fucking high school. So
yes.
It's been a while. I haven't kept up with what the fucking Tesseract was doing.
I'm going to try to piece it together. I'm going to look at the list of movies because I feel like I need the list of movies in front of me. It is its first appearance in Captain America?
Oh, yes, it is in Captain America because they're using it to build the Hydra weapons.
Yes.
I forgot.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wondered if it was even earlier than that, but I think, okay, it is because that's the thing in that movie is that happens, and at the end of that movie, he's fighting Red Skull, and the Tesseract opens a portal, and Red Skull gets sucked into it, but so does the Tesseract.
Yes.
Or does the Tesseract go down with the ship? I don't remember what happens to the Tesseract, actually.
Maybe it does go down with the ship. It's one of those two.
Because I think... It's either at the end of Thor or Captain America where you have the scene where Loki is controlling Erik Selvig and he's looking at the Tesseract and it's in S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters. So S.H.I.E.L.D. got it somewhere in there, which is Captain Marvel is where they get it. I think it must have gone through the portal because that's the only thing that could explain its presence in Captain Marvel.
Yes, but I have now looked up a Vanity Fair article that is called Captain Marvel, The Long History of that End of Credits MacGuffin, Who Had What and When, which I got to by typing into Google, what's up with the Tesseract? So it looks like Captain America the First Avenger is the first appearance of it.
Okay.
I'm trying to see if I can see what happened to the Tesseract at the end. So yeah, it shoots Red Skull into space, and so then that's when he ends up at the Soul Stone planet in
Infinity War.
Then they find it. Yeah, so they find it when they pull up Cap, which I think happens maybe in a post-credit scene at the end of Verse Avenger.
Okay, but that doesn't make sense then if it went down with the ship, because how is it in Captain Marvel in the 90s?
Well, so they pull up the ship, but Captain America doesn't wake up.
Oh,
so, like,
okay.
They have his frozen body for a while. So they have that before Captain Marvel starts.
That is
so
not then, how they play it at the end of that movie. I know that movie very well. They pull him out of the ice in the 2000s. Like, that's fine, but that's retconning on the part of Marvel.
I'm looking at a GIF right now with a bunch of people. There's Howard Stark there.
Is it
looking like he does?
Okay, but they don't pull up his body. They pull up the ship, not the body. That's now I remember it. You're
correct. But there's a body in this GIF. I don't know. I'd have to watch the end of that movie again. It's been a while. But then it's Captain Marvel happens after that, and then Thor happens after that.
Okay.
So because it's on Earth when Thor happens, but that is where Loki has been to Earth and he has used it. So that is a scene from Thor, where Loki has used the Tesseract to control Selvig.
Okay.
And then Avengers happens.
And Avengers, it's the big MacGuffin in the Avengers.
Yes, and then it has a cameo in Thor Ragnarok.
Thor The Dark World, because that's where they give it to the Collector, the Benicio del Toro character.
Yes, and then in Infinity War, that's when Thanos destroys it and takes the gem out of it.
Okay.
But so does that mean we never know where the Tesseract originally came from?
No, we've never seen that.
Because that's where I was confused, because I just felt like at some point we must have surely found out how the Tesseract got to Earth, which is why I was like, oh, I guess that makes sense. That I guess the Kree found the thing, and in this version of Mar-Vell made the Tesseract. But then I was like, but that couldn't have possibly been the thing, because I feel like it was in movies like Captain America that happened earlier. So I guess at some point, somehow, that gem got put into a weird box and ended up on Earth.
Here's the magic of the Marvel formula, though, Sean. We are spending way too much time on this. If you knew nothing about any of that, Captain Marvel is every bit as enjoyable.
Yeah,
you do not need to know any of this shit for this movie. It is pure Easter egg, right?
Yeah, I guess my point is, like, it felt unnecessary to put the Tesseract there, because since it wasn't clear to me why it would have been significant that the Tesseract was here, it just felt like it just made it more confusing. That's like something I wish the movie had done a little bit better job at, of like making, if you're going to use the Tesseract, make that feel like it's a significant piece of information that's like, oh, that puts some piece of the puzzle together, instead of being like, I guess that puzzle wasn't quite solved, but was it? And it's just made me more confused.
This is the 21st Marvel movie in 10 years, Sean. There's we're going to have more of this. That's all I can tell you.
I can't wait to watch the movie Marvel's The Tesseract, where it just is, it's a clip show of all the scenes the Tesseract has been, and it makes it very clear where the Tesseract came from. And there's some new footage. There's like 10 minutes of new footage.
I thought you were going to say it's a TV series on the new Disney streaming platform. It's going to be It's going to be 8 seasons long, and at the very end we're going to find out how the Tesseract got into the hands of the Red Skull.
Yeah, and the pilot episode of the TV show is just like re-edited footage from all the movies showing us where the Tesseract has been and where it's going.
All right. Let's talk about some characters, Sean. We talked about Captain Marvel, obviously. We've got some returning characters. Let's hit those really quickly. The major returning characters in this one are Nick Fury and Agent Coulson, Clark Gregg. I will say my quick 2 cents on this. I always like both of these characters. The digital de-aging on Nick Fury is amazing. Like 95% of the time, I would say it is like seamless. And then 5% of the time, it's scary, uncanny valley. Clark Gregg was 100% of the time scary, uncanny valley, and it bothered me. And I kind of wish they had found a better way to have Coulson in this movie if they needed Coulson in this movie. But I did enjoy having Sam Jackson have a big role in a Marvel movie again.
Yeah, I basically agree. I don't think it looking worse on Coulson bothered me as much. Because it also just, it felt a little bit weird because he just didn't look that much younger to me. Especially considering that, I guess, I've always assumed that Agent Coulson was supposed to be younger than Nick Fury, which this movie kind of would corroborate, considering their, like, relative positions in the organization. But it then just, like, he just looks like he has more hair, but he looks like he's the same age, just with some more hair.
They could have gotten away with Coulson in a wig and that would have been fine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, Sam Jackson, who, you know, like, Coulson has a couple of scenes, but Sam Jackson's like the co-lead of this fucking movie practically. He's awesome. I'm glad that they just, as we kind of talked about earlier, they just mostly let him be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was smart to sort of like find this characterization for a younger Nick Fury, who's like still, you know, clearly like a badass and is going to be the Nick Fury we know, but he hasn't seen all the shit yet. He's like naive in a way we've never seen Nick Fury before, because his character is always like sort of weirdly all knowing and he's like two steps ahead of everybody else, which is true of him in the movies and the comics. Like, to the extent that in his first scene, when he's first introduced in the phone booth scene, and Captain Marvel starts telling him about the Kree and the Skrull, I was half expecting, like, Nick to start laughing and then be like, yeah, no, the Skrull, we know. Like, because I just assumed, like, Nick Fury must know about the Skrull. Like, it's fucking Nick Fury. He knows everything. And to have him just be truly ignorant of all that stuff is like, okay, this is different. Because I legitimately thought that Nick Fury was going to laugh that shit off and be like, yeah, no, the Kree, the Skrull, I get it. Yeah, we've got, like, five Skrull corpses in the fucking back of the trunk. Like, we're cool. Yeah, shapeshifters, all that shit. But no, he doesn't know anything about any of that. This is very clearly set before this world, you know, knew about aliens and knew about superpowers outside of Captain America, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. Because Nick Fury usually is, like, in a position of power, or mentorship or something, like, you know, in the early movies, he's very much, he is the dude in charge. Like, mm-hmm. you know, he does not let Tony Stark talk him around, right? In this one, though, it is very different in that this is an origin story for him as well, and you very clearly see that it was this encounter with Carol Danvers, with Captain Marvel, that sort of set him on the path we see him on in the other films. And I liked that. I think it works as an origin story. I like that he got his eye scratched out by a demon cat. That's a great little detail. And yeah, Sam Jackson is fun. And also, those effects, they just shouldn't be allowed. They shouldn't be allowed to do it this well. It's insane that in, like, remember how crazy it was when they did, like, the two shots with Michael Douglas in Ant-Man, and we're like, That's insane. How did they do that? And now they've just done an entire movie where they took one of the most recognizable actors on the face of the earth and kind of seamlessly made him look like he does in his most famous movie, Pulp Fiction. You know, like, mm-hmm. it's insane.
Yeah, it's a shocking thing to see sometimes. It is one of those where you take a step back and there's a sort of a Jurassic Park moment of, you know, we spent so much time wondering if we could do it that we didn't wonder if we should do it kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sam Jackson is alive and he was playing the character and like is getting paid and all that. So it's totally fine. It's not a fucking Rogue One scenario where it's like you're pissing on the grave of a beloved character actor.
Yes.
But yeah, it frightens me sometimes where we are in our society. But yeah.
Quick interlude. My brother Thomas, who's in Japan, just called me and I told him I can't talk, I'm podcasting, and I said, "Do you want to tell the podcast anything?" He texted, "Not really." And then 3 minutes later he texted, "Peanut butter is really expensive here." In Japan. Should we text him back anything, Sean?
So I'm curious if the intent of that was not, this is something that I want to be read on the podcast, actually, I came up with this idea, or if the intent was, I'm going to clearly tell you that I have nothing to say on the podcast, and 3 minutes later, I'm going to send you the thing that I was going to tell you about, which was that peanut butter is very expensive in Japan. I don't know why you would want to know that. Alternatively, I don't know why he would want the audience of this podcast to know that. But I am personally grateful for the information.
Okay. I'm going to ask him if they have wasabi peanut butter.
Okay.
Don't they have wasabi everything?
I don't know.
We have not been to Japan. Anyway, update on that in a minute. All right. Let's talk about Let's talk about the new characters we've got in this movie. I mean, the two other... you have three other, like, big character actors who come in. You have Annette Bening as Mar-Vell. You have Jude Law as the bad guy. I don't remember his name. I should probably bring up a list of character names because they're all weird alien names.
Yeah, it's a bunch of Kree bullshit, so it is hard to remember.
So you have Jude Law, and then you have Ben Mendelsohn, who... I love Ben Mendelsohn in this. We'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, let's read these character names here. Okay, we have Ben Mendelsohn is playing Talos, is his name. The Skrull dude, Talos. Let's see here. Annette Bening is, Mar-Vell. Dr. Wendy Lawson. Jude Law is Jon Rogg. That was not said in the movie. There is no way that was said in the movie.
Well, I think I know a good reason why that was not said in the movie, is that the movie is clearly setting up for, like, if you know the backstory of Captain Marvel and you know that originally there was a Kree dude named Mar-Vell, in the comics, this, where Captain Marvel comes from, is there's a Kree dude named Mar-Vell who came to Earth and decided he was going to be a superhero on Earth and you know, save the day and stuff. And it clearly feels like they are setting up, if you know that backstory, that there was originally a dude who was a Captain Marvel, that Jude Law is Captain Marvel and has passed on his powers in some way to Carol, and that feels like that's like they're playing with that. And so then when they reveal, because that's why when they reveal the name of the Annette Bening character as, oh, she's Mar-Vell, that's why that's supposed to be, like, a thing. Because they say that name, it's like, oh, that's, like, oh, my God, my mind is blown. Which it was a thing that worked for me, and then I stopped for a second and was like, but for most people, that's not in any way... The only reason why that would in any way be significant is because it vaguely sounds like the word Marvel, and this movie is called Captain Marvel, even though they never call the character Captain Marvel, nor does she ever adopt the name Captain Marvel, or anybody is not named Captain Marvel in this movie. So there's, like, a weird moment for me where there is, like, I understand why that's significant, but it shouldn't be significant in this movie. But that's probably why they never ever say that dude's name, is because that would just give that away.
Okay. Anyway, I think this is interesting, these kind of three character actors, and particularly, I really love the casting of Jude Law and Ben Mendelsohn, because Ben Mendelsohn, who is a great actor, has definitely been cast in a lot of villain roles. Like, that has been sort of his niche over the last few years. I feel like the movie he came to prominence with is a movie called Killing Them Softly, which is like a gangster film that Brad Pitt is in. I didn't love the movie. I loved him in the movie. And then he was on the Netflix show with Kyle Chandler, something about Bloodline, I think is what it's called. And he's been in several superhero movies where he plays the bad guy. I had to look it up and be sure that Ben Mendelsohn had not been in a Marvel movie. He has not. He has been in Star Wars movies. He was in Rogue One. But anyway, so he's been in a lot of things, and so you expect Ben Mendelsohn is going to be the bad guy. You cast Jude Law in something. Jude Law does have this, you know, very, you know, warm, inviting, almost kind of paternal aspect to him where you trust Jude Law. Jude Law does not play a lot of bad guys. They seem like they are cast in the exact roles you're going to expect them to play. And the movie is a lot less predictable than that, and I like that. And I like that you get Jude Law being a bad guy and being kind of a very just prissy asshole bad guy who she kicks the shit out of at the end and leads to probably the best line of the movie. And then you have Ben Mendelsohn getting to play this side of himself he has not gotten to show, certainly in big Hollywood movies, in a while, and be this very, like, kind, thoughtful dude who maybe has done some bad things, but we really come to like him. I came to love Talos by the end of this. And also, I just have to say, the makeup and prosthetics throughout this movie are Star Trek as shit, and I love it. Mm-hmm. That's like, they look like fucking old school Klingons in like the old movies, and it's great. It is so cheesy, and it's so good. And I love that none of them are CGI. They're just people in makeup. I like that Marvel is keeping that up. But anyway, what did you think about those characters?
Yeah, I love both of them a lot. I think they're well, like, love for the Jude Law character is maybe different, but I think he's, like, a really effective, interesting antagonist, especially because that, like, that twist really did work on me, because I can totally see another version of this movie where they play that more straight, mm-hmm. and it is, like, a vaguely, like, it would be a slightly more Green Lantern version of the story than actually how Carol Danvers got her powers, because she didn't, like, it wasn't a thing where Captain Marvel passed his powers on to her, because they both existed at the same time. They just both had Kree-related powers. That's the only reason why she's called Ms. Marvel. But, like, I could see a version of this movie played straight where it's like, oh, I am Captain Mar-Vell of the Kree military, and something happened, and my powers got transferred to you because of some bullshit that happened on Earth, and that's why you have amnesia, but we're just pretending you're, like, Kree, and because all my amazing powers were passed on to you, we need to train you so that you can fight for the Kree because I can't do it that way anymore because I'm not superhero guy anymore. And it's like, because that felt like, to me, that was... using stuff I know from the comic books, I thought that was vaguely where the plot was heading. And I could totally see that version of the movie being really good. But I think playing with the expectations and pulling out that twist at the end did make it much more interesting. And particularly, I think it made, with the way that Ben Mendelsohn plays that Skrull guy, Talos, really works so well. Because he, because when you see him early on, you're like, yeah, I guess he's a villain. But there is always something to the performance, even in that first scene, where it's like he's a little bit lighter and he's a little bit funny and he doesn't take things super seriously. He's not trying to be menacing. So he never quite felt like, oh, this is like a truly villainous performance. But I didn't never really figure out how they were going to fill that hole until we got pretty close to the twist. It's like, okay, makes sense that now the Kree are going to be the bad guys to fill that like true like menacing villain hole. But putting those pieces together and kind of following along, and every time you revisit that Talos character, kind of reassessing him a little bit, I think it was an interesting trick and like an interesting way to put that together, and ultimately maybe really root for that Talos character.
I agree, and I think the same of what you said about Ben Mendelsohn, that he's supposed to be the bad guy, but something is off about the performance, where you're like, he doesn't seem all that bad. There's the same thing with Jude Law, where Jude Law, you expect to be like this like kind of fatherly, nice guy. And he is that, but he also has these, like, edges to him throughout the movie where you're like, but this doesn't feel right. Like, in retrospect, the movie does spend a lot of time foreshadowing what's going to happen. Like, they have Jude Law being kind of menacing on the phone with Captain Marvel. You have, you know, the Ben Mendelsohn character, as we said, being not all that evil, seemingly. Just, he's supposed to be evil. We're told that. You know, I've seen a lot of reviews for Captain Marvel referencing, like, oh, this is the Marvel origin story formula. And I guess I get that impulse to call it that in the broad strokes, but it's actually playing with the formula pretty intelligently, because I think the mental block I had in place that stopped me from seeing where the plot is going is that I've seen a million of these things, and mm-hmm. a plot where Jude Law and Ben Mendelsohn are exactly who we think they are going to be is the version of this movie we've seen before. The movie where they wind up swapping roles midway through is genuinely surprising, and I think it plays on convention very intelligently in that way, and in so doing gives these two actors a lot of fun things to do, and gives Brie Larson in the middle a lot of really fun things to react off of, especially when you find out that Ben Mendelsohn is just kind of this, like, older dad in the Skrull, and he's just trying to get to his family, and he's just very beleaguered, and her having to figure out how to play that antagonism and into friendship is really funny, I think.
Yeah. And then I do also want to echo what you said earlier about the makeup, particularly for the Skrulls. I just love their commitment to, they just look like fucking Skrulls, and you're right, like, it's Star Trek as fuck, which makes sense because the Skrulls were designed when Star Trek the original series was still on the air. You know, the Skrulls are like early Fantastic Four stuff, I think is where they originally came from. So they have like the weird chins and they're all green and everything, and they do the shape-shifting stuff, which I also think the shape-shifting effect, it looks really good and is like just gross enough to be cool, but not quite gross enough to, like, you know, be too much for like a young child audience. Like it like toes that line in a way I really appreciated. But yeah, like I just think the effects work is very dedicated to making it, you know, physical based, which is good because so much of the rest of the movie has to be so digital with the way that Captain Marvel's powers work, that having like these very tangible looking alien guys to hold on to is much better than if they had tried to do a, like, you know, the way that like the Chitauri look or something in Avengers is fine for that movie, but if you had to try to convince me that one of them is like a character, would never have worked.
No, you have to have prosthetics.
Yeah. Putting a dumb looking green prosthetic chin on Ben Mendelsohn, I am sold. Good. That's a cool dude. I will pay attention to that dude because he seems cool.
I also love that the way they signal Jude Law is an alien is the only thing they do, other than the costume, is they give him yellow eye contacts. Mm-hmm. And they are just the lowest rent Party City yellow glowing eye contacts, and they look dumb in every shot, and I love it. It is, like, I can imagine the directors of the movie, like, being in a meeting with, like, figuring out how yellow the contacts are going to be, and someone brings in, like, oh, these, and, like, these look like realistic eyeballs some being in our universe might have, and they're like, it doesn't look stupid enough. Like, it has to look, there's a tone we're going for, and he has to be this cheesy. It has to be this cheesy to work. Pump up the yellow in the eye contacts. I feel like that totally was the memorandum here, and it works perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you never forget they're there, and it has to be that level of distracting.
Yeah, I just like this. Feels like Jude Law, like, avoided the thing in the contract that, like, Jennifer Lawrence could never manage for the X-Men thing of, like, I just don't want to be blue.
Yeah.
Because all the other Kree people are blue, and he's like, I just want to be blue. Because I think in the comic books, like, I think there's a reason why some of the Kree are blue and some are not. I've never been that into that side of shit, because I'm more of, like, the Spider-Man Daredevil kind of thing. But I like that this movie just doesn't even try to address it. Like, there's no point ever where Carol Danvers slash Veers, when she's, like, fully Kreed up, she never looks in the mirror and goes, like, hey, guys, how come, like, you're all blue except for me and fucking Jude Law? Like, why are we the only ones that aren't blue and everyone else is blue? It just seems like a thing you'd ask yourself occasionally.
Yes. And then we do have the other two major women in the movie. You have Lashana Lynch, who plays Maria Rambeau, who is Carol's friend from the Air Force. And you have Annette Bening as Mar-Vell. I like both of these actors a lot. Annette Bening, obviously, is one of those people you get because she carries a certain weight with her. You just buy her in a role like that very quickly. With both of them, and I think it's because of the kind of fractal nature of the storytelling, I wish we had more with them. Particularly, like, I do think Brie Larson and Lashana Lynch have a good, like, friendship chemistry. It's just most of the time we spend with them is when Carol does not remember this person, so it doesn't come across as strongly as it should. I do think the kid, Maria's daughter, kind of ironically, is kind of the most interesting of those secondary human characters in the movie. Because of her specific relation with Carol. What did you think about those characters?
Yeah, I agree. I like them all, but I also agree that they are the characters that suffer the most from, you know, the sort of plot moving things around and trying to make things out of order and playing with that stuff to execute on the twist. Because it's the kind of thing, going back to what you said about it feeling like it's almost like this weird, like, super pilot to a Saturday morning cartoon, is that those plot elements would work better in a TV show where once you have execute on the twist and it's like, oh man, what an awesome twist, you then get to have a season of a TV show building the relationship between Carol and her best friend and then getting more flashbacks, developing her relationship with Mar-Vell and sort of, you know, being able to flesh out those characters in a way that a, like, truly episodic series could do. Whereas this movie feels like it does the bare minimum with those characters to sell the relationship, but that's not enough to fully buy it. And it's especially when, you know, her relationship with Mar-Vell is supposed to be so, you know, powerful that she's the person that she trusts and respects the most of anyone she's ever met, so much so that even when she loses her memory, that's who she sees in the AI interface. Like, you never have a good flashback scene that cements exactly why she feels that way. Like, there's a lot of implication of, you know, here's this other woman who has, you know, this older woman who is in, like, a position of authority and power in the same kind of sector that she wants to be in. It's science instead of, you know, flying a plane, but it's still kind of like in the military trying to do the right thing. But, like, you know, this powerful woman working her way through, like, a man's work, you know, kind of thing. I get, like, the movie definitely, like, implies that, and I get it, and it's, like, a good characterization, but you just never get that, like, one or two juicy flashback scenes that fully cement, I think, that relationship.
Yeah. All right. Where should we go with that? Let's talk about the twist. We've been talking around it a little bit, but the turn from the Kree are good and the Skrulls are bad and we have to defeat the Skrulls to actually the Kree are, like, waging a false flag war against the Skrulls to, like, they're basically doing, like, a horrible genocide against this basically peaceful alien race. And the movie becomes about, you know, Mar-Vell was actually trying to save this one family of Skrulls or this one colony so they could go and try to save the other ones and use this light speed drive to get away from the Kree. And so the focus of the movie turns into Captain Marvel, Carol, turning her allegiance against the Kree, protecting Talos and the other Skrulls, and getting the discovery of the light force drive and everything so they can go off and you know, be peaceful, and then at the end of the movie she's going to leave to go fight the Kree. I really liked this. I like that this is a movie that has, you know, a ton of, like, outer space bullshit, and it gets really silly, and literally the main team in the movie is called the Star Force, which is so dumb, and I love it. I love Jude Law having to say the words Star Force multiple times. You know, like fucking Juilliard. I don't know if he's actually Juilliard trained, but, you know, he feels like that kind of actor. And he's saying Star Force. It's great. But I love that what it comes down to is this very intimate thing of we're going to save this family. We're going to save this colony. And then off screen, we know Captain Marvel is going to go off and do some bigger shit with the Kree. But the focus here is just writing this, like, one injustice. You know, I do like it sometimes when Marvel gets a little lower key like that, and I think it works. Like, I really like the last act of this movie.
Yeah, me too. I think, because the last act is where everything comes into focus, which is why it feels like maybe they held off too long, is because once everything comes into focus, it works so well. Because that scene where all the Skrull refugees come out when they're on the sort of, like, orbiting Kree station that's been hidden, and all the Skrull come out, and I particularly like that little touch of the kid walking over, and he's like, my high score on this pinball machine, and then Sam Jackson's joke is like, yeah, if I was stuck with one pinball machine for 6 years, I'd have a pretty good high score too. But it sells the sort of harrowing nature of the lives of these people in a really effective, sort of very efficient and economic manner, and it, again, it gives a sort of clarity to the movie that, okay, this is what we're fighting for. It's not this weird abstract, like, Kree Skrull war or whatever that you're never really shown because you can't be shown it because it's not what they're saying it is. So it's like all that stuff, it's like very abstract and weird. And when it all comes into focus, okay, we're fighting to save these people because we care about Talos, and we care about, and Talos cares about his family, so we care about his family too. And then we care about doing the right thing, and the right thing generally is not blowing up a space station full of, you know, children and like defenseless people.
This has been Morality 101 with Sean Chapman.
Well, yeah, and I think it also, you know, it only like very like lightly skirts up against this stuff, but there it does with the fact that Carol Danvers was a, you know, a U.S. Air Force pilot, and so she was part of the United States military, like. Again, I'm not saying, like, this movie is not diving deep into the subject matter, but it does at least brush up against this notion of, like, who is the giant empire that are like the Kree in real-world Earth today? And who is Captain Marvel / Carol Danvers? Who is she working for initially that she kind of has to turn against? And, you know, who is she fighting to ultimately protect? Like, it's making you think about those questions at least a little bit, or it's, like, poking against them enough that I appreciate that it's there. That it's, like, not, you know, it's not just sort of, like, totally ignorantly playing up all the, like, U.S. military stuff and, like, how awesome it is to be an Air Force pilot and a jet fighter and the U.S. military. It's, like, well, it's more complicated than that, and the movie acknowledges that at least in its own little way, and I appreciated that a lot, and that they're not, like, just sort of skirting past all that stuff, that it's there.
Yeah. You know, people have noted that Captain Marvel is not a particularly action-packed Marvel movie. I didn't really think about that when I was watching it, because action means a lot of different things, and it is a very propulsive movie to me. Like, it does not have a lot of slow moments or anything. But I guess that's true in the sense of, like, the big major set pieces that are the centerpieces of a lot of Marvel films. There's not a ton of that there. Although I do think what we get is fun. Like, there's the scene where she jumps onto the train and finds the old grandma being the Kree or the Skrull and punches her in the face, and that's kind of funny. And then I do like the stuff at the end, like where she fights her old team, and the song that I used as our theme song this week plays, and that's just a great moment where some of the 90s nostalgia in this movie was a little too much for me, but that was, like, perfect. And just generally, the action at the end of the film is fun. Like, I did not get the sense that this is a filmmaking team. Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, something like that. I forget their last names. That's felt super comfortable with the action stuff. Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, yes. I didn't get the sense that they were super comfortable with the action stuff the way some directors are. But I did think when they did it, it was often character-focused and fun and enjoyable.
Yeah, I do think the action is the one area that this movie falls behind some of the other kind of mid-tier Marvel movies. And I think it's why it ends up being mid-tier, because I think some of the main plot and character stuff is a little bit better than, like, a Doctor Strange. But in Doctor Strange and the Ant-Man movies have much more interesting, creative, like incredible looking action scenes that do way more like fun, different kinds of things with the available like power sets. And because that's the thing about those movies that I honestly probably like more than anything else is I like seeing all the crazy shit they do with Doctor Strange's powers. I love seeing all the weird shit in Ant-Man and Ant-Man 2 that they do with growing, like making things big and making these things tiny. They're really well choreographed, thoughtful, creative sequences. And Captain Marvel like is fine, and it feels like it's one of the things that makes this movie feel a lot like a Phase 1 Marvel movie, because that's how the Phase 1 Marvel movies very much were. It's like there are a couple action scenes that are like fine, you know, like the action in Captain America: The First Avenger is decent. Like there's a couple of decent little scenes in Thor where he's hitting people with his hammer, like it's decent. Like the same thing with the Iron Man movies. Like there's a handful of okay action sequences.
Iron Man is sub decent kind of under Jon Favreau, I would have to say, in the action department.
I think Iron Man 1 has it's not even really like the much of an action scene. I just really like the mid scene in that movie where he flies and blows up the tank. It's like cool. But yeah, particularly the fights against villains in the Iron Man movies were never good, no matter who was making them. It's something that makes it feel like a step back for the Marvel movies in general, which they have gotten so, so much better at doing the action scenes. Because the other thing they've gotten much better at is making villains, which luckily Captain Marvel also like appreciates from that. So like Captain Marvel has a really effective usage of its villain stuff, but doesn't quite feel like it's all the way there with the action. And ultimately, I kind of wish they went like, I wish they just went full Dragon Ball with it, because they're like brushing up against it. They're like nudging up against like this is basically just should just be a Dragon Ball fight scene or action sequence or something, because she's just flying around and punching people across rooms and firing giant energy blasts from her hands. And I feel like if they could have found a way to really execute on that power fantasy at the end of the movie, I think I would have found it like it would have pushed it over the edge for me in a certain way. If they had managed to really sell the sense of like, oh, her powers have like totally exploded, and they do, like she does a lot of cool stuff and she blows up spaceships, like it is a lot, but I don't feel like, I think there's the losing a certain like sort of visceral quality and like very kind of tactile quality to the powers, that if they had found a way to ground it in some way or maybe go full anime with it in some way, it could have sold that part of the movie a lot better for me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, the last Marvel movie before this was Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I think is a weaker movie than Captain Marvel overall, but it does have that third act that is that crazy chase through San Francisco and through the miniature world and all that, and it is one of the most fun action, you know, based sequences Marvel has ever done. And this does feel like a bit of a missed opportunity given the powers of Captain Marvel. And I get there's a difficulty because you cannot have Captain Marvel go full powers early in this movie or middle of this movie. You kind of have to hold it for the end, or else, especially in the small scale story they're telling here, there's no danger, right? But I agree. I think there's something they could have done at the end, maybe a little bit bigger. You know, I'm curious because it feels like this is a character who they could do a lot with in Avengers Endgame and in future movies, and I wonder how much they're going to push against that. It's very similar to Superman in that regards, where you're always wondering, you can do anything with Superman. What specifically are they going to do with Superman, you know?
Yeah. But, when at that scene where Captain Marvel, like, they have her, like, tied up or whatever, and she's in the AI thing, and she's, like fully releasing her powers, they should have just literally made her go Super Saiyan. Like, there should have been, like, I'm saying 100% without any irony at all.
I agree.
They should have made her hair stand up, get rad and spiky, and just go, like, let's do a live action Dragon Ball Z scene. Like they should, because that so much felt like the vibe they were going for was building up to that kind of like power fantasy when Goku goes Super Saiyan or Gohan goes Super Saiyan 2 for the first time. And it's like, I want to like feel the crackle of the energy, you know? They just don't quite push it far enough.
It's true. You know, I'm thinking about it. The last time a major Hollywood movie tried a Dragon Ball style fight scene was The Matrix Revolutions, the Wachowski brothers at the time, Wachowski sisters now. And, you know, Agent Smith versus Neo at the end, which is a great, cool, you know, airborne fight. But that was 2003 special effects. I would love to see it with 2019 special effects, you know, in a movie like this. But yeah, So I'm curious. I mean, I do think the thing about an Ant-Man or a Doctor Strange or something like that is that they have such specific powers, it kind of forces you to be creative. I think there's a danger in Captain Marvel or in Superman or in someone who is very strong like that, in that because you can kind of do anything, sometimes you don't get that creative with it, and I do think it's something that falls a little flat here. Although, I still think it's an effective ending, like the ending where she is the really well-edited montage of her standing up throughout time, standing up again, halfway going Super Saiyan, and then having the big fight where she, you know, tears through the entire fleet. It's awe-inspiring. It's supposed to be awe-inspiring. I think it could be a tad more if they had, like, pumped it up just to 11 a little more, but it is still a very effective climax. It's does right by the characters throughout, and that's what matters most. But yeah, sometimes you do watch these and wish they would cut loose just, like, 10% more.
Yeah, and it is, I just feel like it is, her set of powers are not conducive to the kinds of action sequences that Western filmmakers do well, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Because it is more like the kind of like big chase scene kinds of things, I feel like, is more where a lot of Western filmmakers have honed their stuff. Whereas this is looking more for that kind of like vaguely kung fu, Star Wars, you know, lightsaber, like prequel lightsaber fight. Like, that's the kind of thing you really need, is this really cool stylized action. And you need a very like particular set of talents, or like a person with a particular set of talents to pull that off.
Yeah.
So I hope that they look in that direction for future movies. Because part of the Kree thing is also they're supposed to have like really cool, weird alien martial arts stuff that they kind of hint at in this movie. But it's like, just go full in that direction of like crazy martial arts with energy blasts, watch a lot of Dragon Ball, and you're good. Just watch Dragon Ball Super Broly and like watch that 5 times on repeat and then storyboard your action scene. That's what I want them to do for the sequel.
If nothing else, just plagiarize Dragon Ball Super Broly.
Fuck it. You know, fucking Zack Snyder plagiarized stuff from that Birdie anime for Superman. I don't know if you've ever seen that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Man
of Steel just basically takes full sequences from that show. It's just like, eh, fuck it. We'll just do that scene because it's cool.
Yeah. All right. I guess I forgot. Man of Steel does try to do the big punchy fight thing, and it is well done in that movie, even if it is plagiarized and in service of a pretty bad Superman story. All right.
Yeah.
I also want to say I think Captain Marvel is a really cool-looking movie. I really liked the production design. I think it uses the frame really well. Like, there's the scene in the flashback where she is walking out onto the hangar, and it's her, and the door's opening. It's been in all the trailers, but on the big screen, it looked really cool. There were a lot of shots like that. But, Sean, god damn it, this theater, our only theater in Iowa City that shows movies, like, you know, Hollywood movies, is so bad. And I'm nearing my wit's end here, because I had the sound problem again from Broly. It wasn't as bad for Captain Marvel, but it was, I'm in a big auditorium, there are speakers across each wall, all the way to the back, like every movie theater in America, and you know what speakers they were using? The two behind the screen. And that's all they were using. They were not using any of the surrounds, so they were collapsing an entire 5.1 mix into a couple speakers behind the scene, which effectively makes it sound like a really bad mono fold-down, and then the volume was also too quiet. So it was just hard to hear the movie. And then also, the screen was so dim. Like, that light bulb in that projector was on its last fucking legs. A lot of Captain Marvel is low light, like, not overly so. The photography is very good, but I had to, like, squint to see parts of it, and it was so annoying, because I was like, I think this movie probably looks really good, but I can't see all of it, and it sounds like it hears really good. I actually really liked the music in this movie. It's by a composer named Pinar Toprak, who I had not heard of before, but I thought it was a really cool, I like Thor Ragnarok. I wish it had gone even more in the kind of electronica direction, but I did like what was there, but I could not see or hear it as well as I wanted, and I just, we need better theaters here in Iowa.
Yeah, it's funny because I was going to say that the movie looked really vibrant to me, but I couldn't tell if it's because the movie's really vibrant or it's just been so long since I've... Because it felt like they must have changed that fucking bulb like the day before or something. Because it's just like, oh my god, the colors are so bright. And not in a way that's like... I mean, I feel like this is a very colorful movie, particularly when she gets her costume.
Yeah.
Like, her costume pops really well at the end when she changes the colors, which I thought was cool. But it was, it felt more like a, like, oh, right, this is the way movies in general are supposed to look in movie theaters. It's just, usually it doesn't quite look this way. It's like, oh my god, like, color, and I could see things. Amazing.
This movie theaters are bad now, generally. It just, yeah. Oh well. There's the good movie theater in Davenport. It is a 50-mile drive, but I'm pretty sure I will be going there for Avengers Endgame, because I would like that movie to look and sound good.
Yeah. I also have to say that when you said that you were having the same sound problem you were having with Broly, immediately my mind went to, at the end of this movie with Captain Marvel, they do the thing in the Broly soundtrack where it just goes, Danvers, 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 Captain Marvel! And just like does that in the soundtrack. And it was like, every movie should do that in its fucking action scenes because it would be so much better.
It's a little weird with a name like Danvers, but it would work, yeah. Be even better if they were just saying Carol, 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 because Carol sounds like, you know, your next door neighbor or something.
Carol is my mom's name.
That so is
that
very true.
Particularly weird.
So, literally, my neighbor. There you go.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, all right, what else to say about Captain Marvel? We didn't talk about my favorite thing in the movie yet. My favorite new character in the MCU introduced in Captain Marvel is Goose the Cat. Goose is a good cat. He's a good kitty. He's very cute. Samuel L. Jackson and him have very good human pet chemistry. And he's also a crazy alien who eats shit. I really liked Goose. Goose needs his own series.
Yeah, I liked Goose a lot. And I thought it was a good joke of the, like, them playing with the, like, oh, it's not a cat, it's a whatever, like a flimling or whatever the fuck they call it. And you're like, no, you idiots, that's just a cat. And it's like, oh, God, no, that's, okay, yeah, that's not a cat. Again, kind of like with the Skrull thing, they push the effects just far enough that it's like, it's pretty gross when he goes, like, full the thing. but not quite gross enough that you can't show it to a kid, which I appreciate that. But that also, you know, thinking back to the thing we said earlier about there's a weird sort of like plot gap or something about what has Captain Marvel been doing. The other plot gap is where has Goose been up to? Like, where was Goose during the fucking invasion of the Chitauri in the Avengers? Because I feel like he could have just eaten one of the giant worm things that the Hulk punches. Like, what, you could have fucking solved that whole problem.
Yeah, that would have been good. I'm reading here that in the comics, Carol Danvers has a cat named Chewie. But they decide, who is named after Chewbacca in Star Wars, but now that Star Wars is part of Disney, they decided, like, we probably shouldn't call the cat Chewie. It's a little too in-jokey, so that's why they named it Goose, apparently after the Top Gun character.
Makes sense.
Yes, but I like Goose. Goose was one of my favorite parts of the movie. It's just a great running thread with the film and, you know, more cats in movies.
Yes, and more Sam Jackson just freaking out about cats and how cute the cat is.
It was pretty good. So we have the end credit sequence where Goose coughs up the Tesseract, which was appropriately gross. But you also have just what's basically a preview for Avengers Endgame, where Carol comes to Earth and you see everyone is despondent. You know, it's pretty much what I was expecting the end credit sequence to be. I feel like they could have found some more of a twist into it than the signal goes out and then she shows up. It was like, yeah, I could have assumed that was going to happen. It'd be weird if it didn't, frankly, given all the buildup, if she just didn't show up for Avengers Endgame, or she showed up at the end and, like, they've already beat Thanos, and she's like, what did I miss, guys? Yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah, it does make me wonder also how they're going to play that in Avengers Endgame, because it's like, I can't imagine they're just going to start the movie and she's just there with no explanation. Like, don't know if they just show that scene again, or...
They've done that before. That felt like it could have been a scene from the actual movie to me.
But I'm just curious to see if, like, it's basically that scene, but it's, like, shot slightly differently or something. I'm just curious to see how that's integrated.
They did that with Civil War at the end of Ant-Man. They showed the scene where they're going to get Ant-Man.
Right.
And it was a different cut of the scene at the end of Ant-Man, so.
Yeah, so I'm betting that's just what it is. But it would be fucking hilarious to me if it did that, like, anime thing where if you, like, skipped the end credits for one episode in the series, you missed that the Earth exploded or whatever. And this is like, no explanation. You have to go back and watch it. It's like, oh, sorry, you didn't watch the post-credits scene? Yeah, the Earth blew up at the end of the last episode. Sort of a big deal. So, yeah, it would just be hilarious to me if, like, someone who just decided, I don't need to watch 5 comic book movies in 1 year. I'll skip Captain Marvel, went and saw Avengers Endgame, and was like, wait, who's this lady? What happened? Like, when did she get here?
Yeah. Anything else to say about Captain Marvel? Are you happy? Should we talk about this? Are we happy the MCU finally has a, you know, female-led superhero franchise?
Yeah, it took a fucking while.
It did.
I feel like Scarlett Johansson's just, like, been sitting in a corner just be like, you motherfuckers, like, I've been here the whole time.
Yeah,
have you not made my fucking movie?
I do feel like Marvel does not necessarily deserve the pat on the back for this one. It did objectively take way too fucking long to get a superhero movie out with a woman in it. Considering they're fucking Marvel, they have plenty of characters they could have done. It makes total sense for Captain Marvel to be the first of them. I just don't know if it needed to be the 20th movie. Like, that's a lot of movies to go without having a woman in the lead. And like, to be fair, there is Scarlett Johansson has been a major character throughout like half a dozen of these movies now, but she has not been, you know, number one on the call sheet in any of them. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, at least DC, it was like their third movie was Wonder Woman, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, you know, yeah, it took them a while to get there, but I'm glad that they got there. Hopefully this just opens up that, you know, kind of like with Black Panther, it doesn't have to be a thing. Like, it can just be like, we have proven they can be very good and that they will make shit tons of money because you have an audience of people that are like lots and lots of people that are not represented in this media but that enjoy it, but just aren't represented in it. And so if you fucking give them some decent representation, they will go watch your goddamn movie. You idiots. I don't know how it takes so long to get to that fucking lesson learned. But now that that's happened, hopefully that just makes it very easy for more movies like this to be made with other female superheroes. So,
I mean, I do feel like we're living in a really interesting moment with Black Panther, Wonder Woman, and this all coming out, all being critically acclaimed to varying degrees, you know, clearly all being audience favorites. Audiences clearly have loved all of these movies. They've been giant box office hits. I mean, this is just another instance, Sean, of if you went back in time and told us that a movie called Captain Marvel grossed $153 million opening weekend at the U.S. box office.
And you'd be like, wait, which Captain? Is that like the guy who says Shazam, or is it the Kree dude named Mar-Vell? Oh, you mean Carol? You mean Miss Marvel?
Yeah, it's nuts. It's a huge deal that it's making this much money. It, especially because I thought, while I was looking forward to the movie, I thought this had more boring marketing, frankly, than a lot of the Marvel marketing. It felt like, and I understand now that I've seen the movie why, like, this is a hard movie to cut a trailer for, because you can't show a lot of the movie in it. But yeah, I clearly, like, the appetite is so overwhelmingly strong for having heroes on screen who are not white men, you know? And it's just, I feel like, if, you know, Hollywood has definitely gone through cycles where they have obstinately not learned the lesson that is right in front of their eyes, it would be to their own financial peril if they decided not to learn the lesson this time, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, anywho, I really look forward to Avengers Endgame now. Gonna get that next month, Sean. Mm-hmm. You believe that's just next month?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that is very soon. I'm definitely looking forward to... I want to see Captain Marvel beat up Thanos. Mm-hmm. I think that will be very cool. I'm curious when they're going to call her Captain Marvel and in what context that's going to happen.
I feel like the Avengers movies are always when, if someone has not either taken the name or done the, like, silly version of the costume, that's where they do it. Like, in the Avengers is when you get the really colorful Captain America costume. They tend to use the character names more there. They joke about it more. So I think she's going to get called that in. There's going to be a joke where, like, Anthony Mackie is like, oh, so what should we call you? And she goes, like, Captain Marvel. You know, I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah, because it just felt like it was a thing I was just sort of vaguely waiting for in the movie, particularly because The whole explanation of the Marvel thing is that the dude's name was Mar-Vell, and everyone was like, and they make that joke at the end with Nick Fury, but they don't ever connect it to Carol anyway, because it's like, oh, Mar-Vell, that sounds like Marvel. Nobody can pronounce your weird Kree bullshit, Mar, so we're just going to call you Captain Marvel. But they just never kind of hook that up in a way that makes it feel weird when they did the end title credits thing where it's like, oh, at the end of the movie, we're going to do the fancy looking credits that end with, here's the title of the movie, Captain Marvel. It is like, but who's Captain Marvel? You just never said it. I just want someone to say it once, please.
Yes. All right. Well, we will see you guys next week. I have no idea what we're talking about next week, but we'll figure it out.
I need to watch some more Gundam. So let's do that.